You're listening to Writer's Block with guest host Ben Ennis and Stephen Brunt on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Blue Jays fans want to have perspective right now, or they want to be told to have perspective right now, but that was the first time the Blue Jays have lost back-to-back games this month.
Yes.
It felt devastating. It's not, in fact, devastating. Every loss is going to feel devastating, and there will be probably another one or two in these final nine games remaining, but the fallout outside of the actual loss was also quite devastating, because the Blue Jays lost their best hitter yesterday.
Yes, they did. We don't know for how long. I guess we'll find out. Did it feel to you like that game was 5 hours long? It did to me.
Yes.
And not five happy hours, right? Not five great hours, but five. Is this, what inning are we in? If this is not going to end well, there's no chance this is going to end well. Who's hurt now? Could this just be over? That's kind of, and I haven't felt that way often in September, but it did definitely felt that way watching that game last night. So there was that.
Yeah,
emotionally it didn't. I understand the emotional wallop of that coming on the heels of the final game in the Tampa series. And I guess all of that feeling good on the plane stuff, you know, didn't necessarily translate.
Was not the turning point in the season that maybe, you know, the Marcus Semien walk-off home run against the A's at Rogers Center on that Friday night was.
Yeah, maybe not. Mats was not good. Those who followed him were not good. Tom Hatch is now hurt, and probably you're not going to see him for the rest of the year. So that takes away one of your kind of emergency, go-to in emergency guys. They had a ton of chances to score and didn't score. The bombs away stuff didn't happen offensively. You had two guys in the outfield, one guy stepping on another guy in the outfield. That's always bad. Doesn't happen that often because outfielders generally keep apart, right? Mm. Yeah. What else went wrong? Okay, Julian Merriweather throwing a letter high changeup to a guy.
Like, oh, there's a guy thrown out at the plate.
Yes.
Who's not exactly fleet of foot with two outs in the top of the order coming up.
Yeah, well, you're trailing by five. Yeah. You would have had runners on first and third. Instead, you send a guy who's a complete dead duck, and poor Louis Rivera is waving, and then goes, no, I really, what I meant was stop. I'm sorry, the waving thing. Ignore the windmilling that I was doing for the last 5 minutes. No, I really wanted you to stop. That was horrible. In that game, with that, like, if it's a one-run game, maybe you do that, but, like, it wasn't that close, right? It wasn't, and he's not very fast, is he?
He's not. I was surprised. I went through his StatCast numbers and expected him to be, like, the lowest percentile of sprint speed. It's not quite that, but he's like 350th fastest man in baseball.
He looked like me, right? Like, I've never been quick, right? And I know the feeling of having to, it's four steps for the other guys too, right? Like, that's what it felt like, is his legs, it took him four strides to do what other guys do in two. Anyway, yeah, it was, but as you suggested, you know, with more perspective, if you step back, you say, okay, they now have three games against the Minnesota Twins who, you know, are not good by record. They do have some really talented offensive players.
Especially now that Mitch Garver's back.
And you know, Buxton's healthy. And, like, that's not a cakewalk. But you have your best three starting pitchers going in these three games. If you win two of these three games, and then you have the Yankees for three, somebody's got to lose those Yankees in those Yankee-Boston games. Somebody's got to lose each one of them. You'll be playing for a wild card against the Yankees next week.
Yep.
There's no way you're not. Okay. So,
and you know what? Let's just get right into the positives of the day right now. Those three games will be played in front of 30,000 fans. Ben Nicholson-Smith now reporting, he has a source that at today's media availability, the provincial government will okay the Blue Jays to allow 30,000 fans. So it wasn't the 35,000. There was a compromise at 30,000. And who knows how they came up with that number of 30, but 30,000 fans will be allowed into Rogers Center to watch the final six games of the Blue Jays season.
Is it okay if I suggest that number was not the product of, like, higher mathematics or modeling, but was pulled out of some orifice? Like,
yeah,
doesn't
yeah,
that make some more
fine.
Sense,
yeah,
right?
That's nice round number, though.
Yeah, it does kind of, yeah.
All the way open, not your 45, 30.
30, because 30 is the safety number. It's great, though, actually. You know, again, we'll have a clip probably from the the chief medical officer of health at some point during this hour, because he's due to appear at the bottom of the hour to announce this officially. And obviously has implications there. There's also going to be indoor, mm-hmm. expanded indoor limits. And we talked about this yesterday. The vaccine, we've bet pretty heavily on the vaccine. The vaccine works if mm-hmm. you're fully vaccinated and you have a crowd of fully vaccinated people, you should be able to, should be pretty much normal. You know, not reckless, but normal. And so that's, obviously the Jays got a little bit of a heads up on this because they've been selling tickets for a couple of days. You can go buy them right now if you want for those Yankee games or those Baltimore games. But it'll be something. You know what that means? What it means is going to feel like playoff baseball. And it's going to feel great, actually. I think it's going to be exciting. It's going to feel normal. It's going to feel like it should for, you know, playing the hated, the evil empire Yankees with a playoff spot on the line. Yeah. Because that's what's going to come. Like, no, it doesn't really matter what happens. You know, like there's one kind of extreme scenario where those games won't matter. But essentially, those games, that's what it's going to come down to.
Yep.
So here you go. You've got a kind of a de facto little mini playoff series played out in your home park with lots of fans in the stands for the first time in 2 years.
Yeah, this is what I've been saying all along, because the Blue Jays were a coin flip to make the playoffs. I mean, they went on that insane run to get themselves into a position where they were a coin flip to make the playoffs, which is crazy considering where they were before that A's series, before that game on Friday that was actually mm-hmm. the turning point of the season. So they might not get there, but you should treat these final regular season games like playoff games, because you know what? Frankly, you might not actually get the playoff games. A three-game series against the Yankees at home might be better than a one-game playoff against the Red Sox anyways.
Yeah, it's pretty good. Like, it's again, if you said to somebody in April, here's what you're going to have in September. You're going to have, 3 weeks of ecstasy and then a little bit of a speed bump and then last week of the season for all the marbles with the Yankees coming into town, with people in the stands. We would all have taken that. So that's going to be a blast. In the meantime, yes, they should try and take care of business against the Twins the next three.
That'd be a good idea. Probably today without Lourdes Gurriel Jr. Let's get back into the bat. Because I got to figure the x-rays are fine. He doesn't have a broken finger, which is good. And there was a moment there when, he immediately removed himself from the game. And Bo Bichette's like waving his arms. It was all over for him in that game at that point. You thought, well, anything's possible. And the hand is covered in a towel. Knew there was some laceration. A couple of stitches, I think, is what he got in his middle finger. So he's gone for, who knows, a day or two. They categorized it as the best possible news on his injury. But I think it's going to mean at least a game or two, maybe the rest of the series. Either way, he's been the Blue Jays' best hitter in September. That is an unequivocal fact.
Yeah.
And Vlad Jr. has rejuvenated his MVP chances. Doesn't matter. Lourdes Gurriel Jr. has been hotter than him and at times hitting seventh in this lineup. But he's been unbelievable. And there was rumblings that George Springer would play the outfield in that game yesterday. I wonder if now that gains even more traction. And while you talk about urgency with the way you deploy your pitching, if there's urgency in the way you deploy that guy at the top of the lineup, who's not exactly swinging it well.
Oh, no, he's not. Look, I'm going to, fingers crossed that if Gurriel has a bad cut on his hand or a cut on his hand, two stitches isn't a lot, but look, I'm sure it's sore and I'm sure it's swollen. But if it's merely about, can you swing a bat and play through some pain, which, I think it would hurt. Maybe he doesn't even miss a game. Like maybe he decides to play. We'll see. That's, I'm sure they're working on that, deciding that right about now with the medical team. But in terms of Springer, it's a grass field. The knee brace is off. He's running the bases. It sounds like it's up to him, the decision, to a large degree. He said he's still feeling a little discomfort with stops and starts. I think that's what they reported on the broadcast last night. That it hurts when he's doing stops and starts, but again, this is why you pay all those medical people. If it's not going to make it worse, now, again, things can happen. Obviously, things can happen in general. But if there's nothing that says where there's a bunch of red flags that say, if you go out in the outfield, you could blow this up and this could have greater consequences down the road, I think he's got to play in the outfield. they don't, it's not like they've got a better option here, right? Like if Gurriel can't play, he's got to play.
Yeah.
There's not, that's not a, position of great depth in this organization. There's not somebody
else. You mentioned
else.
It the other day that, yeah, that they need outfielders organizationally.
Yeah, they do. They do. And there's just no one you can throw out there. So, would they, this is, again, we're getting into all kinds of stuff here, but, would you find a way to Kevin Bijou on the roster and have him play the outfield?
That's what I wonder.
That's one possibility. Would give you a left-handed bat. I don't know what he gives you offensively. I have no idea. He's an adequate corner outfielder,
yeah.
An adequate right fielder.
Is it better than what you're going to get out of Corey Dickerson? And that, but I mean, if Springer's not playing center field, that means that you've got Grichuk and Dickerson.
You know what? It's probably really similar.
Yeah.
Unless Bijou has absolutely figured it out,
yeah.
And comes in and he's got the crazy eye at the plate and I think we know what Dickerson is now at this stage. I think we've seen enough. He's he's a guy who hits from the side where you don't have a lot of guys hitting, and he's okay in the outfield, but you'd rather not have him play center, and he obviously can't run. and he's a below average offensive player who maybe if he gets a little bit warm could give you a bit more than that, but that's about it, right? Like, no, you're nothing to get excited about. Like, there's zero to get excited about, but it's not a, oh my God, disaster. I hope they don't hit the ball to him.
Mm-hmm.
So somewhere in between those two things is what he is. So that's not, yeah. So I don't know what their feeling is about Kevin Biggio right now. And I know, he's had a couple of encouraging games in AAA,
mm-hmm.
but that's AAA. It's a different thing. We didn't see anything out of him really this season when he was healthy to suggest that anything other than a bit of a, that he'd fallen backwards from his best. And, I think we've seen that in general, like with him, that the league figured him out a little bit and now he's got to figure things out. He's an overachiever to get where he is, and he's going to have to overachieve again. But
none of them are Lourdes Gurriel Jr.
No,
that's for damn sure.
No, they aren't. For all of his, unpredictability defensively,
yeah.
Boy, yeah, he has been mashing, and he's been mashing for, 4 months now?
He's a bit star-crossed, too, when you think back at his career. And I think Arash was mentioning this on the broadcast yesterday in his conversations with how good he feels at the plate and whether he's ever felt this before, and mentioned the fact that, yeah, when he's felt this way before, it's always coincided with an immediate injury. And he's never played 100 games in a Major League Baseball season, understanding that last year was a 60-game season, but even that one, he was banged up. And for the first time ever, now it was an inconsistent start to the season for him, but he got through the 100-game barrier, and there hadn't been the soft tissue stuff. It's a freak accident that takes him out of the lineup, maybe, again, knock on wood, that everything's okay for him, that takes him out of the lineup when he's playing his absolute best baseball.
Yeah, it's a killer, and it's a fluke injury, right?
Yeah.
It's not one, like, as I say, the number of guys who have had their hands stepped on in the outfield in the history of baseball, I think that's a short list.
Guys collide heads. That happens.
Run into walls, collide heads, pull hamstrings, twist ankles, et cetera, et cetera. But generally, outfitters are not in a position where you can get your hand stepped on at second base. That's not that hard.
No.
But it's pretty tough to get your hand stepped on in the outfield. There's a lot of outfield. There's a lot of space out there between guys. So that, yeah, it's a freak injury. But I guess we will hear. I think Arash is on the 4 o'clock hour today. So we will have Arash Madani direct from Minnesota with the latest, and I would think by then he'll have a pretty good idea what's going on.
Yeah. Maybe we'll have an idea of what's going to go on in that Tuesday start in the coming days, but and that's the opening day of the Yankee series in front of 30,000 fans now. Again, according to Ben Nicholson-Smith, who's reporting what we're going to hear officially in about 15 minutes' time. If yesterday was an audition for Steven Matz, it was a tough one.
It was.
He only gave up the two runs, but you mentioned it felt like forever. It felt like forever because Steven Matz had thrown 80 pitches through three innings. And we discussed this a little bit in the newsroom about the idea that it was a no-brainer going to Hatch in that fourth inning when it's a 2-2 game. I mean, Matz did not look good. He was able to – he got through it, though. It was just it was a tie game. It was a 2-2 game. And sure, if Thomas Hatch looked like the guy that we saw pitch some pretty high leverage, important eighth innings last season for this Blue Jays team, maybe I see it. And I guess he was okay before he got hurt in his last start in that doubleheader game against the Orioles, where he sat in the ice tub as the Blue Jays had 11 consecutive hits in the seventh inning. But the guy that we've seen in AAA all season long to try and keep it at a 2-2 game, I don't know about that decision. I know Mats wasn't great.
Well, where else you go? Like, who else is going to pitch more in an inning for you?
Back to Mats, though. I would have run Mats back out there for a fourth inning to see if he had turned it around a little bit to that.
He just looks so gassed, though. You know, those innings were so long and stressful that, you know, it was 80 pitches, but it felt like 120 pitches.
Yeah.
And they were in a bind, right? Because they didn't, you know, Stripling is their multi-inning guy. He was used up, right? They've already, so they used him up the day before. You don't really have a long guy in that bullpen. And you needed somebody at that point, you know, to give you three innings, ideally, maybe even two, and just kind of get you through it and hope that the offense would come around and then get into your, you know, the circle of trust relievers. And instead, like, I understand why they did it. I'm not sure that there was a good alternative right there. And Matt's just, the other thing with Matt's is, you know, like, again, his issue has been historically, going back to his Mets days, his issue is not about stuff. It's not about his arm. It's about confidence, right? It's about dealing with adversity in a game. And maybe you want to protect him a little bit in that, because you might need him on Tuesday.
Yeah.
You know, you still might need him on Tuesday. So you get him out of there. You know, the games hasn't gotten away. He's not completely spent. And he's, you maybe, you know, maybe he lives to fight another day. But at that point, if you decide that, then the only place you can go is Hatch. Like, I don't see anybody else in that bullpen. Otherwise, it's, you're going to run through everybody. And, you know, and then that, yeah, that's, it was pretty obvious with Hatch, you know, right off the top that he didn't have the best stuff. And then it got worse. So he's gone, right? So you're not going to see him. You will not see him again this season.
I'd be surprised.
I'm shocked. So, you know, you know, listen, for a team that's got, that has had very good starting pitching and has at least a core of guys in the bullpen who are been very, very good, they're going to have some tough decisions about, you know, the situations which will arise, not just, you know, during the last parts of regular season, but if they get into the postseason, you know, situations will arise where, you know, your starter doesn't give you six or seven. And, you know, and somebody's tired and you need somebody to give you a couple of trustworthy innings, and there's not a lot of candidates for that right now.
What'd you think about Merriweather in that situation? Because the lead was already lost by that point, but yeah, a one-run lead against this offense should not be insurmountable. The Blue Jays didn't score again, and I understand it's only the fifth inning, right? Like
I'm not rolling the other guys out in that situation with three games to play in this series.
Yeah.
I'm really not. Like I think you've got,
you know, it's the bottom of the order, too. He got taken yard by a guy who has a career high, I think, of 9 home runs in Gordon.
Yeah, and a guy he blew 2 fastballs by him, right? It just is
that was infuriating that he went to the changeup. And Joe Siddall's right. If he buries that, if he throws it where he wants to throw it, it's probably the end of the inning.
But he's not, you know, who we were talking about, I think it was Buck, we were talking about this week. You know, Merriweather's effectively, this is spring training, right? The guy missed the whole year. So, yeah, the velocity's still there. He's still at 99, still on the fastball. But, you know, there's a lot of stuff that kind of – the reason baseball players take forever to get ready for a season is because, it does – you know, pitchers kind of establishing command takes time. So there might not be enough runway, but I kind of think, again, if you don't run him out there, who do you run out there? Mm-hmm. Like, honest to God, you're not going to run Trevor Richards out there, right? You're not going to use him. You could run Simber out there, I guess, but really? Are you going to do that in that game? I'm not – I think you want to keep your powder dry a little bit for the three you've got coming up. And that's not a conceding that game, because as you say, it was a one-run game at that point. But there weren't a lot of – I think what you had to do in that game, which you'd have to do, everybody has to do at some point, is you put a guy out there and you hope.
Yeah.
Right? You put a guy out there and you hope that it's his good day.
It's a really strange game for the Blue Jays. They had 11 hits.
Yeah. And didn't feel like it, though, did it?
No. And – they were actually okay with runners in scoring position, too. They were 2-for-8 with runners in scoring position. So there's a lot of, like, I think it was the first 5 innings, they had at least a hit in every single inning. But it was singles. It was, not a lot of situations for lots of scoring.
No, and Pineda looks incredibly hittable. Like, he just looks like he's there. You know, he's there to be hit. And I guess that's the frustrating thing. You saw Vladdy a couple of times where he just missed.
Yep.
And he knew it. But you know, Pineda doesn't throw hard at all anymore. It's just a lot of slop. I know he's been around forever. He knows how to pitch, but he felt very, very hittable. And it just, there wasn't a lot of great contact. There were, kind of a lot of bloops and bleeders and things like that that added up to some of those hits. Never felt like the big offensive explosion was coming. You know, again, maybe Maybe Dickerson doesn't get thrown out on your first and third, and you've got you got the potential to build a bit of a rally there. Maybe that's the moment, but you're digging yourself out of a hole by then.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, a funny game, like you say. There were it didn't feel like they had that many hits. It didn't feel that competitive.
No,
didn't. It kind of felt like that last Tampa game. It just didn't feel like they were really in it.
So they're due to not have a game like that. And in these final three games against the Minnesota Twins, they have the decided pitching advantage in all three of them. It would feel devastating to lose today. Not that yesterday didn't feel devastating to Blue Jays fans, but it is just a one-game deficit. And somebody's going to lose between the Yankees and Red Sox today. Although all of a sudden, you got to look down at the Mariners, who are a game back. They just swept a four-game series against the Oakland A's.
Yes. Now, they have, I got to look at their schedule.
They have six of their nine remaining against the Angels.
Yes. So that could be not hard.
Yeah.
They're not good. I refuse to believe that the Mariners will make the postseason. I'm sorry. I can't do it.
I can't either.
I can't. I just can't make myself believe that. So I'm going to pretend that they're not that close.
Yeah, but they are.
I know.
Incredible fun differential this season for the Seattle Mariners, and kudos to them for getting to this point. And yeah, six of the nine remaining against the Angels and the other three against the Oakland A's, who I think at this point are
deceased.
Yes, they are. All right, let's take a break. Let's talk to Arden Zwelling of Sportsnet and the At the Letters podcast next as Writer's Block continues. Ben Ennis, Stephen Brunt, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. All right, the deficit is one game, no half games. It makes the math neat and tidy. I do like looking at the schedule, not seeing that little, that hook there, the half game.
But no game in hand now, which was kind of comforting, right? The mystery game in hand. Now it's gone.
Nope. Every day the Blue Jays play from here until the end of the season, the Yankees will play that exact same day for three of those games against the Blue Jays. Let's talk to Arden Zwelling of Sportsnet and the At the Letters podcast. How's it going, Arden?
Fellas, how are we?
We're very well. What is this Blue Jays team without Lourdes Gurriel Jr. if he has to miss some time here?
I would be surprised almost if he didn't miss some time, right? You consider two stitches in your hand. It's probably pretty hard to throw a baseball with stitches in your hand, and you have to wonder about his ability to grip a bat as well. So it's almost surprising if he's back in there tonight. So yeah, I think they're going to have to be without him. And it's interesting because he had kind of, with this run that he had been on for the last 4 weeks, 5 weeks, whenever it started, he had very much inserted himself into that quote-unquote core of Simeon, Guerrero, Bichette, Hernandez. I mean, Lourdes Gurriel Jr. was right there with them as a no-doubt everyday player, always in the lineup, no longer a part-time guy, which he was earlier this season. So that does hurt a little bit to lose his production from the lineup, but the Blue Jays have plenty of other talented hitters as well.
They do, Arden. You're right. It's hard to imagine. Look, I will get the medical update at some point. It was obviously a messy enough injury that the guys on the field said get the guys out here fast to deal with it. And I assume it's swollen and it's sore. And we'll see if he can play. But if he can't, what about the? I'm a little puzzled as to what the deciding factor is and whether George Springer can play the outfield or not. But do you think this could potentially accelerate that decision?
I think it would help the decision for sure. I think they're always going to do what's best for George Springer long term. And I don't think they're ever going to put him in a position where he can make something that he's clearly playing through right now a whole bunch worse, mm-hmm. significantly worse, just because of obvious reasons and what they have invested in him. And also what we've come to learn about George Springer, I think, guys, over these 5.5 months, and that's that there is only one gear with George Springer. Mm-hmm. There is no playing, just kind of easing his way towards the wall. There's no, maybe I won't run head first and dive spectacularly after this one. There is only one gear, and he only goes all out. So you have to be cognizant of that. So I think you want to be very, very sure that he's not going to make an injury a whole lot worse if you are throwing him out there, so that it impacts him, beyond this season, which would be a real disaster scenario. So we'll see. But look, George Springer's been talking about getting back in the outfield for quite a while now, and the Blue Jays have been taking steps to get him up to speed. I had always kind of thought that the Yankees series back in Toronto made sense. Maybe we see it this weekend now, particularly with Gurriel out of the lineup.
Well, you you actually raised a point I hadn't thought about. If Gurriel just can't throw a baseball, he can't play defense and requires the DH spot, maybe that's the reason that you accelerate the Springer to the outfield thing. Because if Gurriel's not playing at all, like how much different are you if Springer's the DH and you got Randall Grichuk and let's say Corey Dickerson in the outfield and Danny Jansen or Alejandro Kirk catching, or Springer's in the outfield and Grichuk is also in the outfield and I don't know, Dickerson's DHing or Dickerson's in the outfield and Kirk is DHing and Jansen's in the lineup. Like I don't know how much of a if Gurriel's not in the lineup, I don't know necessarily how important, how much you lose if Springer is still the DH.
Yeah, there's so many unknowns there, right? It's can Lourdes Gurriel Jr. grip a bat today? And we really don't know. And they've got those little pieces of rubber that you can kind of wedge between your finger and the bat to sort of gain leverage if you aren't fully able to grip the bat. Like there are ways they can sort of make it comfortable for you. They can shoot you up with a bunch of pain meds. They can alleviate your discomfort. But we'll see where Lourdes Gurriel Jr. is at today. If he's able to DH and he's able to be productive, I mean, that does change things a little bit because he's been hitting so much better than George Springer has recently. And you would like to have Lourdes Gurriel Jr. in your lineup for these games that you have to win if he's at all capable of replicating the offensive production we've seen from him recently. It might be a little bit too much to ask after his, you know, Randall Grichuk essentially punctured his hand just last night. I mean, we're just going to have to see where things stand with him and also how capable George Springer is of playing the outfield. Because it's always possible that they throw him out there and we see after that first ball is hit to him, oh no, this is not what we want at all. So there's a lot of unknowns at play here.
Arden, who do you think starts the game on Tuesday against the Yankees and how do they make that decision?
Hyunjin Ryu starts on Tuesday. I think that's always been the way that they were going to go. He's getting these 10 days off now to just kind of get over any of the bumps and bruises, any of the wear and tear that he's been carrying this season. And he's going to be right back out there against a club who, by the way, nobody mentions this. Last time he faced the Yankees, which was like 3 weeks ago, 6 shutout innings.
I mention it.
3 singles. Oh, well, of course you did, Ben. But allowed 3 singles, no walks. I mean, he was great against that lineup. So I know he has been hit and miss lately. We all know that he's been hit and miss lately. But we've seen him good against the Yankees very recently. And like we all know with Hyunjin Ryu, sometimes he pitches through things that maybe other guys wouldn't. And sometimes he carries injuries on the mound that can affect his velocity and affect his ability to command. So maybe these 10 days are what he needs just to get past that and just have one last burst towards the end of the season. I mean, he would only need to start, you know, Monday or Tuesday's game against the Yankees, certainly, and then maybe the final day of the season, maybe. But you might not even need him to start that one. So if he can get well enough to be effective on Tuesday against the Yankees, that'd be pretty big for the Blue Jays.
It would. I got to think they'll be, you know, and we've been kicking this around all week because it's, you know, the thing with Ryu is, it's, you know, it's going to be hard to know watching him because, you know, he has been throwing some sides during this stretch, which he doesn't normally do. But you don't necessarily know what you're going to get until he gets out there because it's not, you can't measure it on a radar gun. Arden, I got to think they'll be holding their breath through the first couple of innings of that game. Like, I'm not saying Steven Matz is going to be warming up to start it, but, you know, and he didn't look good last night, obviously. But, you know, you they don't have a lot of options right now to backfill innings that they're going to feel good about. If that Ryu from 3 weeks ago shows up, I would think they will all be thanking their lucky stars. I guess the question is if he doesn't, you know, if it's the guy we've seen the last couple of starts.
Well, a contingency plan will be in place. We all know that for, you know, if he doesn't have it, because those Yankees games are essentially playoff games.
Yep.
Next week, and they need to be treated as such in how you fill out your lineup, in how you make in-game pitching decisions, in the amount of rope that your starter has. You have to manage those like playoff games. So if Hyunjin Ryu goes out and doesn't have it, if he's given up lasers in the first inning or he walks, you know, 2 of his first 3 batters, somebody's probably getting up in the bullpen. I don't think there's going to be any hesitance to do that, and that will have been prepared for. There will be avenues and off-ramps that Charlie Montoyo and Pete Walker can take. Look, you got a 28-man roster right now. You know, you could bring up an Anthony Kay if you needed an absolute, you know, disaster emergency scenario guy. You'll probably have Ross Stripling in that one ready to go behind Ryu if you need him to as well. You'll be coming off of an off day. You'll have options. Guys, like, if you run into a situation in, say, it's like the third inning and you've got a tie game and Ryu's put a couple runners on, and you know, say like a Rizzo or a Gallo, one of those big lefty bats in the Yankees lineup is coming on in a leverage spot early in a game, you could go to Tim Mesa. Mm-hmm. You could go to a leverage arm early in that game. You have to manage it as if it is the playoffs. So that's how crucial those games are going to be for the Blue Jays. So you're absolutely right. There's going to be contingencies in place in case Ryu does not have it on Tuesday.
Yeah, 100%. You probably won't have Thomas Hatch available. Not that he would have factored into that series, but yeah, he seemed like he, well, I guess they called it a hamstring injury, what he suffered yesterday. It's like, this guy was a very, very effective reliever for this team, a playoff team, albeit in a 60-game weirdo season, but he was a very, very good reliever for the Blue Jays, and the numbers just overall, and I know he was injured outside of the injury he suffered yesterday. He's been injured at times this season in Buffalo, but as a starter, the numbers never really jumped off the page. He was a guy I was excited to see in a starter's role this year and thought he would factor in to the rotation. That was back when the Blue Jays rotation was not a strength at all, projecting going into the season. What do you see as the future for Thomas Hatch? At a certain point, you know, guys do get the starter label removed from them and put into the bullpen. Is it too early to think about Hatch's future as being that?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's funny. We expected to see more of this in terms of players who just had a hard time in 2021 coming off of some uncertain roles and some unusual circumstances in 2020. I really expected we'd see a lot more of it than we did. And I think every team has situations and cases like a Thomas Hatch who in 2020, I mean, as you mentioned, he had never pitched out of the bullpen before. And then he was asked to fill a bullpen role with the Blue Jays last minute, not something that he had prepared to do going into 2020. And all of a sudden he was facing 6, 7, 8, sometimes 9 hitters out of the bullpen, sometimes, you know, never really pitching on back-to-back days, but sometimes only having a day or two off in between, like, some pretty laborious outings. He was typically going 20, 30 pitches. It was unusual for him and uncomfortable, and he spoke about it. You know, he talked about how hard it was for him to learn how to do that and to take on that role. And as you mentioned, he excelled in it, although I do sort of remember him slowing down the stretch a little bit, not being as great towards the end of the season, and maybe that was a little bit of a foreboding sign for what was to come. And then he tries to get back on to sort of a starter's routine here in 2021 and do what he was doing before, and injuries start cropping up, and he has trouble, and the velo wasn't quite there, the fastball wasn't performing or behaving the way that it had in the past, and then obviously the situation last night was just sort of tough to watch. So this season, you know, it looks a lot like a write-off for Thomas Hatch, and I think that he just spends this offseason getting right, getting healthy, getting back to what the Blue Jays believe he can be, and that is a starting pitcher, and sort of starting with a clean, healthy slate at 2022 in Dunedin.
Yeah, no, that sounds about right. So as we speak, Arden, the Chief Medical Officer of Health for the Province of Ontario is, I believe, announcing the upped capacity for live sporting events, including 30,000 people at the Rogers Centre. Have you kind of allowed yourself to think about this at all? Like, it's going to be, you know, like, it's not just like a throwback to the last time we saw, you know, a normal crowd, and it's going to go immediately back to like 2016, you know, because it's going to be a crowd for games, as you said, that are de facto playoff games. It's been cool with the 15,000 people in there. I've been down there. It does feel like more than 15, but we're going to be immersed suddenly in the best of it, really, the best of live baseball with a real crowd. It's kind of hard to imagine, isn't it?
Yeah, happy days. I'm glad to see it. I think it's an important step. Throughout this pandemic, right, we have heard over and over again about how there's going to be a new normal. And I feel like we are sort of arriving at that world in which COVID-19 exists and we exist with it, a world that has vaccines that work, and that, you know, you encountered 9 out of 10 Torontonians, 9 out of 10 of them have taken the vaccine, a world that has vaccine passports and places you can go and cannot go if you're vaccinated or unvaccinated, a world that has situations like going to a ballpark of 30,000 people that involves risk. just as all situations do, just as you get in your car to drive to the ballpark, and there's risk to that, or if you ride your ballpark, or you ride your bike, excuse me, to the ballpark through city streets, there's risks to that. And everyone's going to have different levels of risk tolerance, and everyone's going to participate in different activities that come with different levels of risk, but we're all aware of the risk. And we all are aware of the protections that are available to us if we choose to take them, as 9 and 10 Torontonians have done. So we can go back to ballparks. We can go back to theaters, back to shopping malls, thanks to the vaccines and thanks to vaccine passports and to masks and all the things we can do to minimize that risk and get to a world and a new normal that is more sustainable than, you know, not having anybody at the ballpark or then shutting down the economy or handing out surge checks. It's a world where 30,000 people can go to a ballpark and accept that risk and enjoy a baseball game. We can sustain that. You know, that could be the new normal. So it's very exciting.
Sing it. I love it. Yeah.
Yes, indeed.
We finally got our lollipop after being good boys and girls over the last months getting our vaccines. You're right. Nine out of 10 Torontonians. That's a pretty impressive mark. Arden, great stuff, buddy. Talk again soon.
Be well, guys. Take care.
You too. Arden Zwelling, Sportsnet, and the At the Letters podcast. So, yeah, now the Blue Jays releasing all kinds of information about ticket sales, and they have tickets as low as $15, apparently. BlueJays.com/tickets is where you can go to get down there at the ballpark for the Yankee series and the Orioles series. Just 6 home games remaining. And to my great embarrassment, I'd never got down to the ballpark in 2015 because I was working like all those days generally.
It was fun.
Yeah.
It was. There's some good stuff happened that year, I think, as I'm told, right?
Like
I
look good on TV.
It was pretty great. 2016 was pretty good too.
Yeah, I know. Well, I got to take my kid, my son, to be 6-year-old. He's turning 6 at the end of this month. Like, this feels like one of those moments. I mean, the opening game at Rogers Center that Friday was something special, I think, against the Royals.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't down there for Friday. I was there for the game after that on Saturday with my family, and that was emotional. I will say it's seemingly more emotional to watch the Friday game, though, from my television. I think that game on Tuesday is going to have there's multiple opening days to this season. Steven, this is like the 5th opening day, it feels like.
It is what it feels like, isn't it? Yes, you're right. It's an opening day is awesome, so more of them is better.
You're not wrong. So, yes, again, BlueJays.com/tickets is where you can go to get those Blue Jays tickets, is capacity increasing to 30,000. All right, more of Writer's Block, and we continue. Ben Ennis, Stephen Brunt, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. So 30,000 fans is what capacity will be for the Blue Jays in the 6 remaining home games against the Yankees Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and then Friday, Saturday, Sunday, the final 3 games of the regular season against the Baltimore Orioles. It sounds like, you know, the more you talk to people, and I think Shai Davidi was on the station earlier today talking about this, the same thing that Arden said, that all signs are pointing to Hyunjin Ryu coming off the injured list and starting that game on Tuesday. And Hyunjin Ryu has been a fine signing, and he made 29 starts already this season, which is a win considering his injury history. It's been an up and down season. First half was up, second half was down. Against the Yankees, it's been up, though, because it goes beyond just the last good start he had at Yankee Stadium as a part of that 4-game sweep. I think his numbers are best against the Yankees than any other team in Major League Baseball, and maybe that shouldn't be shocking because the Yankees haven't exactly thrown out one of the all-time great lineups this season.
No, they have not. This is not. I heard Nick Swisher on the station with Blair and Barker. He did refer to it like as Murderer's Row. It's not. I don't think they were. They don't even Wounder's Row, right? Like not like. It's not like they. Yeah, they've got, you know, like Judge and Stanton are huge, and if they hit the ball, it goes a long way. But there's a lot of you know, DJ LeMahieu hasn't had much of a year.
Holy cow, man. Like, yeah. DJ, I was watching one of the games recently, and he, again, came up short and, like, struck out in a big moment. And it's his average is fine, but the power numbers that he displayed last year in that shortened season seem like that's not ever going to happen again.
Yeah, and they've got five more years of him, right? So there you go. But sometimes be careful what you wish for, because he could have been a Blue Jay. He very much could have been a Blue Jay. But and, you know, maybe he'll bounce back next year. He's still a pretty good professional hitter. But, no, you can I don't think I'm not, you know, like, taking away a 13-game winning streak is not fair, because they did win 13 games in a row.
Yeah.
But outside of that stretch, you know, they just haven't been very good. They've been okay, you know, just okay. And I, you know, I really don't like any aspect of that team better than I like the team here. You know, starting pitching, you know, maybe their bullpen when it's, although they got so many guys banged up now, but, and Chapman's starting to pitch a little better.
A little bit.
But, you know, I take the Jays starting pitching over their starting pitching, and I would take the Jays lineup position players over their position players.
Honestly, I would probably say the same about the Red Sox, but the Red Sox have put themselves in such a spot since wearing the yellow uniforms, which apparently they're going to be allowed to wear into the postseason. But,
Lord.
They're three games now up on the Blue Jays. And, yes, they play the Yankees for three, so that could go either way. But they end the season with the Orioles and the Nationals. So they have six games remaining against some of the dregs of all of baseball. And we know, you know, it doesn't always play out according to Hoyle. But the Red Sox, with the advantage in the record already and considering the soft underbelly of their schedule going forward, I think it's going to be pretty difficult for somebody to knock them out of a playoff position.
Well, they haven't folded to this point, right? And yeah. And as much as you might have been skeptical to start the season and looked at them and said, okay, at a certain point they're going to come back to earth, especially with Sale not there. They're just not that good. The pitching's not that good. They do score a ton of runs, right? They can be a very good, very effective offensive team. But I think as we ended the last week of the season, I would say they are, you know, they're as good as their record would suggest they are. And I could, yeah, it's almost impossible to see them imploding in this last week and a bit. So, yeah, I think I'm not going to say they're home and cooled out, because you can't with the standings, but they're pretty close.
Yep.
Right? They're pretty close.
So, I don't want to be a prisoner of the moment, but Hyunjin Ryu has had some moments where he could come up large.
Mm-hmm.
He did start that second postseason game against the Rays after they lost the first one in a well-pitched game. Remember how surprising it was that Robbie Ray was going to start that thing or piggyback Matt Shoemaker, and the pitching was not a problem in that game.
No, it was not.
Hyunjin Ryu was a problem, though.
Yeah, he got shell.
Only three earned, but seven runs on eight hits, and he just got five outs.
Yeah.
And there have been moments this season. Again, you got to win in that four-game sweep of the Yankees at Yankee Stadium. There will not, and I would even put this above that second postseason game against the Rays after losing the first one. And that was a team that eventually went to the World Series. And that was, like, you want to talk about this being kind of ahead of the timeline. Last year was way ahead, and it was expanded playoffs and yada, yada, yada. This start on Tuesday is the biggest moment of his Toronto Blue Jays career.
Yes, it is.
And people will fairly or unfairly look at his season and maybe the signing as a whole to this point, because at the conclusion of the season, his contract will now be halfway completed. I can't help but feel like so much of the Hyunjin Ryu story is riding on what he does on that Tuesday against the Yankees.
Yeah. I've gone down this road a bit anyway. Like, the signing when it happened was important for a whole bunch of reasons, which were not about immediately winning a championship, right?
Yeah.
They were, because, you know, that came, you know, near the depths, after the depths of the rebuild. And this, you know, by the way, everybody, it's been a really short rebuild. You know, like, this, go look around baseball. It often takes longer than 3 or 4 years to, you know, go from the playoffs to 95 losses and back to the playoffs.
Think the Orioles might have wanted to sign up for what the Blue Jays did as far as a rebuild?
Yeah, because, yeah, they were both in the playoffs in 2016. Let's just put it that way. And, you know, who's got a better shot right now? Yeah, I think that signing was important on a whole bunch of levels. And to convince a guy like that to sign in Toronto at a time when you were just coming off a rebuild and, you know, really kind of putting all your eggs in these great young players who were coming along, but the competitive window might not open for another 2 years, I think that was kind of a show of faith signing as well, right? That wasn't – so that – yeah, I think you got – what I'm saying is you got a lot of the bang for your buck already just by signing him.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was, you know, kind of a – you know, like, he's this the second half of this year has been troubling. But and obviously that start against Tampa in the postseason, whatever that thing was last year, was awful. But I still think you've got to kind of like if there's two more years here of him and they're not going to be great, or he's not going to be at the back of your rotation and not the front of your rotation, it's okay.
Yeah, you that know, is okay.
Because you've evolved, right?
Yeah, and I would say that, you know, psychologically, like he was a big part of, and you can scoff at whatever that means, getting into the postseason in a weird season with expanded playoffs and 60 games and what would have happened in 162, and look at the teams they finished ahead of. Well, one of was the Red Sox, but there was reasons for that. But that was impactful to where the Blue Jays are now, and he was a guy that finished top five in Cy Young award voting. He was a huge part of it. He wasn't a part of what they did in the postseason. The postseason lasted two games.
Exactly.
But he was a part of getting them to that point and getting that team meaningful baseball reps during the regular season and at least a taste of the postseason. It now can be said that Bo Bichette and Vladimir Guerrero Jr. have postseason experience, and partly because Hyunjin Ryu had a great year last year.
Yeah, and maybe, like, I'm not saying when you go out to try and sign George Springer, like, I think when you try and sign George Springer, if you give him the most money, he'll probably sign with you. But, you know, players do care about, you know, where an organization's headed and the kind of, you know, the gestures that have been made towards being competitive, spending money, investing in it. And, like, does the Springer signing happen if the Ryu signing doesn't happen? Like, that's, I think, look, we'll never know. Mm-hmm. And maybe if you gave him a dollar more than the next team, you got him. Mm-hmm. But I do think that kind of, I think players notice, you know, and they also notice in your own clubhouse, by the way.
Oh, yeah, there's no doubt about that, yeah. And Scott Boras definitely noticed.
Yes.
That his phone rang from a number he did not recognize. And now he's saved that number in his phone. But yeah, second half has not been very good for Hyunjin Ryu. He's pitched to an ERA of 5.61. Has a chance to change the narrative on Tuesday, though, it looks like, against the New York Yankees. When we come back, interesting narrative for the Raptors coming up this season. The first without Kyle Lowry in a long time. We'll talk to a guy that knows him very well and has an increased role on Sportsnet this year. Newly minted Raptors analyst for Sportsnet, Alvin Williams, joins us next as Writer's Block continues. Ben Ennis, Stephen Brunt, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Writer's Block, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, Ben Ennis and Stephen Brunt. And our next guest has been in and around our Raptors coverage for years and now has an increased role. He's a Raptors analyst alongside Matt Devlin for the TV broadcast here on Sportsnet. It's Alvin Williams, Raptors legend. How's it going, Alvin?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing very well, Alvin. So when did you know this was going to be happening for you, and how long have you thought about this, and what do you expect in this increased role doing all these games for Sportsnet?
I have a lot of question marks. I don't know anything. I'm just going with the flow, enjoying everything. It's always been something that I was interested in doing once I even was doing the in-studio, pre-game, post-game stuff in studio. So, you know, getting the opportunity to actually call the games, be there at the games, be around the team, and being part of MLSC, you know, in a closer fashion, I'm so excited, man. You can't put words to it. I'm really excited. So it's been a long time coming, but I'm ready for it.
Well, congratulations, number one, and I'll tell you, it's a good time to be starting this gig, because if you'd done it, you know, last year, obviously everything was at a distance and arenas were empty and the team wasn't here. It looks like you're going to be going back where I haven't seen exactly what the capacity is going to be for the Raptors starting the season, but Alvin, they're announcing today that there's going to be a significant number of people in the arenas to start the season. So, and back home at the Scotiabank Arena, that's got to be, it's an exciting prospect, just being at a real basketball game with real fans and, you know, feeling that atmosphere for the first time in a long time.
You're so right. You know, just, I know for me personally and selfishly, getting to be back in Toronto, being back in the arena with the fans, and, you know, that's the best part. Although, you know, Tampa wouldn't have been bad in the wintertime, but
yeah, that's
it's
true.
Still not the, right. It's not being in Toronto, and for me, like I said, personally, getting the opportunity to come back to my second home and be amongst the fans and friends and the team again, the organization, it's definitely a blessing and something I'm looking forward to.
Talking to Alvin Williams. So it is a strange time, though, in Raptors history without Kyle Lowry. And the expectations of perennially being in the playoffs, and then the idea of how deep they can go in the playoffs. It's different expectations for this franchise. What is your feeling going into this year surrounding a team that's just been year after year, save for last year, which was so bizarre, expected to at least finish above 500 and into the postseason? That would be a nice result this year, but maybe not expected.
Yeah, there's still a lot of uncertainty. You just don't know. You know, Kyle is not there. Just, you know, the fabric of the team for so many years, the toughness that he brought, the leadership, that's not there. But, you know, with that being said, a lot of the younger players, they have a great opportunity to step up, and they are more than capable of doing that by, you know, being in a situation where they've won championships. They've been around a lot of great leaders. So the young guys, the Pascal, Fred, OG, these guys are primed and ready to be, in my eyes, the leaders in the new direction of the team. And they should be excited about it, and I think everybody else should be excited about it, because they will get an opportunity to lead the charge, I believe.
Elvin, what do you expect from Pascal this season? Because so much about, you know, where this team can go in this, especially in the short term, depends kind of on, you know, where he goes and how he continues to evolve, and, you know, how he fits into that role as kind of a first option for this team in a lot of circumstances. What do you think he is right now?
I expect him to be great. I expect last year was a year of, it was newness. It was a situation where he was the guy that would have the ball at the end of the games. He had to be more consistent, and he had his ups and downs. But like any great player, I don't care who it is, Kobe Bryant, Allen Iverson, Michael Jordan, everyone, before they got to that superstar level, they've had those ups and downs. They had to go through the trials and tribulations of taking on that new role as the guy or as someone that the team relies on you night in and night out. And he had that opportunity last year. As tricky as that season was, as uncertain as the season was, whether it was location, the COVID, everything that went on, he still played at a level that the team needed him. He played good basketball. It wasn't as consistent as we would like, but he played good basketball. And I think this year he's going to showcase everything that he can really do on a consistent side.
It's a different role, though, what Kyle Lowry did. At times, he was the best player on the floor for the Raptors, but he was on the floor last year, and Pascal Siakam was, I think, most people viewed as the guy that was going to be, like he said, having the ball at the final moments of close games. Where does Fred VanVleet fit into all of this? And do we make too much of the leadership role that Kyle Lowry played for this team throughout his Raptors career?
Oh, no. You know, I don't think you make too much of it. Leadership is what drives, you know, the championship. It drives the culture. It drives the foundation. And I think that's part of why the Raptors have been successful these past 10 years, 8, 9 years, playoffs, championships, Eastern Conference Finals, because the leadership from top to bottom, from ownership down to the coaching staff to everyone in between, it's been in place. And I think the players is just as critical. But I feel Fred can take on that leadership role because he has the demeanor, he has the game, and he's learned from Kyle Lowry. He's experienced that. And one thing that Kyle did that people probably do not know or underestimate, he was a leader off the floor as well. You know, he brought people, he galvanized people, he brought the whole team together, whether it was at his house, wherever the case may be. So the leadership is critical, and I believe Fred is also, he could be that type of person. Will he be Kyle Lowry? No, no one's Kyle Lowry, but he can definitely be a leader for that team. And it could be a leader by committee as well. It could be multiple leaders.
What do you expect, Elvin? You know, Scottie Barnes, what do you think, you know, the difference will be between the guy we see on opening night and the guy we see at the end of this season?
I love him. I watched him in summer league. I got a chance to talk to his college coaches, and what you see so far, that's who he is, an energetic, a happy person, a person that's truly excited to be in Toronto, to be an NBA player. And truth be told, he has a lot of skill. For him seeing him being able to handle the ball, his athleticism, I think he can learn so much from Pascal Siakam and then be a great complement to Pascal Siakam on that other side of the wing along with OG. So I expect big things for him. He is a rookie. He's a young rookie. So there's going to be, you know, ups and downs, of course. But I think the future is very bright for Scottie.
How do you ease him in, though? Because so much attention is going to be on him, especially with Pascal missing the start of the season. But you're the fourth overall selection, and you're a surprise one at that, that fans are obviously going to scrutinize his play, but understanding that he's a developing player and maybe the offensive skill set is not the finished product. A lot of people point to the Pascal Siakam start to his NBA career where he was like a starter in name only and was playing about 10 minutes a game. Is that the path for Scotty Barnes? How do you massage this? How do you get the best out of Scotty Barnes, and how do you treat his development in a way that makes it easier?
Well, I think with Scotty, it's a little different. I believe the Toronto Raptors at the time when Pascal was a rookie, they were more established. They were a better team, I believe, across the board. Right now, the team that the Raptors, they're growing, and you're still trying to find that identity. So with someone like Scotty, who first and foremost plays with a lot of energy, I think you put him in there. And you don't put many responsibilities on him as far as scoring the basketball, but allow him to be him who he is and then continue to grow into a role, grow into a development side. And I think he has that capability. You know, when you have a player that can do multiple things on a court and not necessarily have his number called to be effective, he's that person. He can rebound the basketball. He can defend the basketball. He's running the floor. Reminds me a lot of a young Pascal Siakam. So I just believe that's one of the guys you throw into the fire. You throw into the fire a bit and then let him continue to develop through his mistakes and through gameplay and experience.
Well, you know, and maybe I misspoke when I said, you know, he's going to be heavily scrutinized, and he will, by the NBA community at large. But I'm talking specifically.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah, for sure. But these Raptors fans, I wonder how they're going to treat him, because obviously anybody that thought that this team was going to draft Jalen Suggs, I'm sure got over those hard feelings and have put all their emotional chips into the Scotty Barnes basket. I understand that. But from what you know and understand about this Raptors fan base, and considering they're going to be playing at home for the first time in like 2 years, how understanding are they going to be of the Scotty Barnes development thing and that he's not going to be a finished product on opening day?
Well, yeah, I believe they're going to understand, because they're going to see him, first of all, his personality. And the fans that I know and I've seen over the history, for him wanting to be in Toronto, wanting to be there, that's already going to put a warm spot in their hearts, the fans, because, and you know, it's been so many years where, you know, Toronto's been a place where it's supposedly, quote unquote, no one wants to go, or whatever the case may be. Scotty wants to be there. He wants to be in Toronto. And then when you see his gameplay, the energy, the effort that he's going to put in, night out, the fan base loves that. It's a hard-working atmosphere. It's a lay it out on the floor every night. It's a fan base that loves that. So he's going to fit right in. And I believe fans are going to forget about a Jalen Suggs or whoever they thought they should have been drafted, because Scotty Barnes is a good, very good basketball player. And he has a high ceiling, and he's going to show and prove what he can really do. I think the fans would be pleasantly surprised if they don't know him already.
Alan, it's a tough Eastern Conference these days, you know, not just the two or three teams at the very top. Do you think the Raptors are a playoff team this year?
I do. I do believe they're a playoff team. I like the way the Raptors ended the season last year, even though with all the injuries and the sicknesses and the change of the lineups. I believe early in the season where the Raptors struggled was interior. You know, they couldn't find that five man that they could rely on. But even with, you know, Chris Bouchard and Birch, they came in there and they create activity. They created a physicality in the paint where the team got better. I feel like Pascal, before he was sick, he started playing more consistent basketball. So I believe the team was on the right path at the end of the year. And I believe this year is going to be a carryover to where they were heading at the end of last year. So I do believe they're a playoff team. Where they are in the playoffs, I don't know where that is, because other teams have, you may make some big improvements. I believe Chicago Bulls made some great improvements. They did it. They stacked up their roster. But the top-heavy teams, you know, the Milwaukee the and Brooklyn, don't know what the Sixers are going to do, but Milwaukee and Brooklyn, they're still tough as well. So, but the Raptors are a playoff team in my eyes.
Yeah, Sixers have a large question mark still hanging over their head. So we'll see how that one resolves itself. Talking to Alvin Williams, newly minted Raptors analyst for Sportsnet. So the news is starting to filter out now in both the NBA and the NHL about unvaccinated players and the problems they will have just playing games. I know Andrew Wiggins is reportedly unvaccinated, and in that County, he cannot enter the building as a home player, so won't be able to at least play the 41 home games outside of whatever restrictions he has. He certainly won't be able to play in any games north of the border. Kyrie Irving, it's been reported, unvaccinated, and the same deal there for Brooklyn. What is your understanding of how this is going to play out here, Alvin, and the feeling amongst players in that league specifically about vaccination?
You know, these past few years, it's been a strange time, and from politically to, you know, health, the pandemic, socially, it's so many things where you're starting to see players utilizing their voice and utilizing their decision making, and it's not unfortunate. It's the way it is, but a lot of people will be impacted by the decisions that players going to have the freedom to make. Unless the NBA puts some type of stipulations or some type of mandates on players where they have to perform and whatever that looks like, I really, truly do not know where we go from here. Because like you said, if Wiggins is someone who cannot play in the 41 home games because there's a restriction or there's something where he has to be vaccinated and he refuses to get vaccinated, then that's things that these teams, the organization, and the overall NBA are going to have to deal with, because it's only going to get worse. It's not going to get better, because more and more people are going to come out and make these certain decisions. For whatever the reasons are, they're going to make decisions that's going to benefit them individually. So teams, leagues, and everyone's going to be impacted that way.
You know what it's like in an NBA dressing room. We don't. What do you think it would be like if one guy in that room wasn't vaccinated? And that put a team at a competitive disadvantage, you know, never mind everything else, you know, never mind the fact that you might not be able to go out and have dinner with the guys on the road or all the other restrictions that might be there. But, you know, given the bond that has to exist on a team, given the kind of chemistry aspects of it, what do you think it would be like if one person said, no, I'm not doing it?
Yes, it's all going to be the makeup of the locker room. Who's in that locker room? We talked about leadership. We talk about the chemistry. And that's a great question, because you just never know how one person's decision or how one person's outlook will impact the whole team. And it could be something that could be detrimental to the team. It could be something that could bring the team together. You just never know where that team or the majority of the people in that team stands. But, you know, at one thing I know, the locker room will figure it out. The locker room will figure it out, whether it's a good team or it's a bad team, whether it's a team in distress or not. The locker room and the conversations and the personalities and characters in the locker room, you will know what's going on in the locker room by seeing a product on the floor.
Alvin, I wouldn't ever want you to speak for all African-American men, obviously, but race is a factor in this, and that we've seen throughout, you know, the start of the vaccination that the rates have not been equal. And, you know, with the history of government medicine in the African American community obviously leads to increased questions. How is this vaccine viewed by you in particular? And like, how does race play into what we're discussing here in this league?
I mean, I think it's a huge part. I think when you're more informed, and then you recognize your history, and there's a lot of things that go on behind making a decision that you don't believe in. And from our country here in the United States, you start seeing people, even from the vaccination, even from wearing masks, people talking about human rights and everything that they are deserved, and, you know, what this country is supposed to represent and give them. You still have a division. You have such a division. But from the black race, and from my understanding and my experience, it's just that lack of trust that the best is wanted for the black community and the black race. So people are going to be hesitant. They're going to be hesitant. They're going to go about things as they see fit and as they feel comfortable. For me, I'm vaccinated because I feel I have a responsibility. I have older parents. I have children. So it's those things that I have to consider, and I step outside of those things because I look at it from a different lens of my responsibility and trying to stay healthy and taking all procedures that may be best for my family and the people I'm around.
It's definitely an interesting conversation, and one that we're not even close to being done having. Alvin, again, congrats on the new gig, and thanks so much for doing this today.
Thanks for having me, guys. Enjoy.
Thanks. Thanks, Alvin. Alvin Williams, newly minted Raptors analyst for Sportsnet. It's, yeah, so I wouldn't change my opinion on the vaccine, right? I still believe everybody should be vaccinated, and I think that there should be, it should be, the rhetoric should be getting harsher for people who are unvaccinated. But that being said, like, and I don't know if this is like sitting on the fence. I do understand the history.
Yeah. No, look, there's, yeah, it's, how do I going to say this? Like I don't, you know, I don't want to offer any more rope to anti-vaxxers, you know, who are anti-science or science deniers or who are dealing with superstition or whatever, however you might want to frame it. But especially there are specific reasons in certain cultural groups where people might not trust the voice of authority, including when it comes to medicine. You know, and again, in terms of the African-American community, there are some very specific things if you want to look it up. You can understand why there might not be full and abiding trust with authority figures in terms of people telling you what to do and what you should put in your body. That's, you know, that's a historical fact. And there might be other aspects of that, you know, in this country with certain groups who might believe they've been betrayed by figures in authority in the past. And that their well-being and their health was not front of mind for anybody. It's a walking a bit of a tightrope here.
Yeah.
I don't want that to put wind in the sails of people, you know, who are doing this for other reasons, you know, including doing this out of ignorance. But those historical and cultural facts and those precedents exist, right? They're not nothing. They're real.
Yeah. We have to consider them when having this conversation. But again, like, I'm not going to waver on my belief in the vaccine and that everyone should do it and that we're going to be a better off place if everybody does do it. But understanding, yeah, where some people are coming from, at least. The pandemic ends for no one until it ends for everyone. UNICEF is leading the procurement and delivery of 2 billion COVID-19 vaccines to countries around the world. An effort of this scale has never been done before. By donating to UNICEF Canada by September 30th, Canadians have the opportunity to make a difference and support the vaccination of millions of people in lower-income countries. Every dollar donated by September 30th will be matched by the Canadian government. Donate today at unicef.ca or text VACCINES to 45678 to donate $10. When we come back, so I don't understand the Mariners. Maybe our next guest understands the Mariners. Eno Saris of The Athletic joins us next as Writer's Block continues. Ben Annis, Stephen Brunt, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Blue Jays continue their three games remaining in this four-game series against the Minnesota Twins. It continues tonight at Target Field, and then the off day Monday, and then looks like Hyunjin Ryu is going to start the opener against the Yankees on Tuesday. The 34-year-old who will be coming off the IL with, I guess, a neck thing, even though he said he was healthy, despite the fact that the last two starts not been great. Let's talk to Eno Saris of The Athletic, who is kind enough to join us on the line right now. How's it going, Eno?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thanks for doing this. Now, you wrote a little bit about how pitchers at advanced ages are able to pitch better than ever, or, you know, continue to keep their velocities up and continue to keep their strikeout rate up. Now, Hyunjin Ryu is not a guy that lights up the radar gun. Do you think that what you wrote will apply to him?
Yeah, I mean, one way that it applies is that one of the ways that older starting pitchers have managed to keep their strikeout rate high and keep their velo high is by throwing fewer fastballs as they get older. And that's definitely something that you've seen over the course of Ryu's career. This year, he's up back a little bit, but over time, he's replaced a lot of four-seamers with cutters. This year, it's the most cutters he's thrown. And he also demonstrates why starting pitchers sometimes age better than relievers, because relievers come in with two pitches, and when they start losing their velo, they're in trouble because that's half of their pitches. Ryu is so excellent at throwing four different pitches in any count and commanding all of them. And so he's the kind of pitcher that theoretically should age really well. And I think in sum, it's been a very good signing for the Blue Jays.
Can you expand a little bit, you know, on that idea of, and I know you wrote about it, but about guys, you know, the fact that we see guys late into their 30s who's you know, the conventional wisdom would have been once, you know, that, you know, well, guys lost his fastball, right? So then, you know, that's the inevitable curve downward is when a guy loses something off his fastball. And yet we see guys, you know, like a guy like Max Scherzer, you have guys who are power pitchers late into their 30s, you know, pushing 40. And why they, you know, again, you said part of the reasons they're throwing fewer fastballs as they go through their careers, but there's also ways to kind of maintain or gain velo these days that maybe didn't exist back in the day, correct?
Yes. I think the superior training methods now, for example, Clayton Kershaw went to driveline and used some of their weighted ball training there to get a bit of a velocity bump last year. But also just the idea of throwing fewer fastballs. This league has become a breaking ball league. Mm. And if you can command your breaking ball, I think you can really throw fewer fastballs. And if you throw fewer fastballs, it's like anything like weightlifting, right? If you ask me to do 20 reps of something, I can do a lot more weight than if you ask me to do 40 or 50, right? So by reducing the number of fastballs you throw, that's the most stressful thing on your arm. That's the thing that's going to take the most effort. And you throw them fewer, you throw them less often, then you can throw them harder. You can throw closer to your maximum. And that's something that's going true across the game. We're asking starting pitchers to throw closer to their maximum velo. Charlie Morton, for example, is just out here admitting to me that he's trying to throw as hard as he can every single time.
Wow.
And so that's what we train for now. If you have other pitches that you can rely on, you can reduce the number of fastballs you throw and still throw really hard.
I was just thinking about the idea that it's a, you know, that it's a breaking ball game in a lot of ways, despite the fact that guys are chasing velo. But there, you know, like how many thousands of high school kids right now or junior high kids are in at driveline, or, you know, there's all those kind of velo sweatshops, right? Where kids are chasing velo, sometimes, you know, breaking down while they're doing it.
Well, I think the main thing that if I could tell someone, if there's a young person that's playing baseball that's listening to this, the one thing I would say is you want to have a good maximum velocity. Like, you want to be able to show someone you can throw 96. But for the sake of your arm, when you're in that high school game, touch 96 a couple times if you have to. Sit 91. Mm. It's so much better for your arm. Leave those bullets in your arm. The closer you sit, the closer you throw to your maximum, the more stress you're putting on your arm. So it's fine to show people it's in there. If you want to get drafted in the first round, you have to show 96 or plus, right? But it's going to be better for you if you don't sit anywhere close to that.
Yeah, it's going to be tough to tell a young pitcher what to do, considering that we could see some, I guess, major rule changes in the off season because while it is, as you say, a breaking ball league, a breaking ball sport, the strikeouts, as you also say, are higher than ever. And that Major League Baseball, under the leadership of Theo Epstein, it looks like, are going to try and do something to eliminate strikeouts to some degree. And I would have initially thought, well, yeah, you got to bring down the velocity of these fastballs in some meaningful way. And I know you've been on here talking about how pitch clocks might actually aid to that. I mean, should we be thinking more about breaking balls when we think about turning down the knob on strikeouts?
Yes. For example, one of the major things they're trying right now is moving the mound back. And they're doing that in independent leagues right now. They move the mound back a foot. That should reduce velo. It doesn't actually reduce the velo. It just reduces the velo as it appears at the plate to the hitter. And theoretically, that should reduce strikeout rates. Guess what? It hasn't. It hasn't at all. And they say they want to try it a little bit longer, but one of the main reasons it hasn't is because it's a breaking ball league. All these guys have good breaking balls. They just throw more breaking balls when the mound is pushed back, and the breaking balls have further to move. They move more because they have another foot to move. Think about trying to hit Sergio Romo's sweeping slider if it had another foot to move. That hasn't reduced strikeouts the way it won. They enforced the sticky stuff ban. That reduced strikeout rate by one percentage point. That's something, but it's not a lot. I think that pitch clocks could do something. There's always the threat of injury because pitch clocks reduce velocity by introducing more fatigue. You're telling them, like the weightlifting example, you're telling them, no, you have to keep doing this rep. You can't just wait every time. You can't wait for a minute between pitches. And so it will introduce fatigue, but I'm hoping that pitchers would train differently and train a little bit more like they used to for more of a marathon than a sprint. If you move the mound back, there's got to be some possibility of increasing injury. So it's a difficult thing to tinker with a sport, but I in general am positive about it, because if you look at other sports, especially football and basketball, they have totally changed the sport as it is played on the field. And I think for the better.
Yeah.
I think basketball and football are better now than they used to be. And I think part of it is those rule changes. So I think baseball should do the same.
Well, football, they rethink it almost on a yearly basis, right? They tweak it every
year.
Really
do.
You know, is the pitch clock, I've been at pitch clock games in the minors, I was kind of aware of it because I was sitting in a press box next to the guy who was the pitch clock guy, right? But otherwise, I'm not sure I would have noticed, to be honest. But do you think they're almost an inevitability at this stage? Because there is that sense that they would, you know, obviously they speed games up, but that they might fix other things along the way as well?
I think the most inevitable thing that I think of is robot umps, the good robotic strike zone. That's already in like AA, so that's coming. I just figure out how you feel about it and put it away, because that's common.
We just watched Joe West's crew work.
Yeah.
I think we know how we feel.
I mean, that's been a steady march from independent to A-ball to Arizona Fall League to Double A. I mean, it's on its way. Pitch clock is kind of one step behind. So it's done independent league. It's now in A-ball. And in A-ball, they're doing a 15-second one, and Jason Stark just wrote a really great piece about how that shaved 25 minutes off the game, which would make games more in the 240, 240. That's kind of what basketball's at. Instead of 3-plus hours, you know, in that 2 hours and 40 minutes, that's a little bit more basketball-like. And so that's what I think they would like to do that. And in terms of how it looks, I have to say, man, I like it. Everyone's moving. It's like, it's more engaging. There's not as much sort of the batter walking around in circles, making funny faces and adjusting his stuff, and the pitcher spitting on the ground and fiddling with the, I mean, is that high drama? Is that what we come to watch?
No. We just watched a Michael Pineda game that went 3:34. So, yeah, no, bring on the pitch clock.
Still going on as far as I know, yeah.
Yeah, no more Joe West. And, yeah, Michael Pineda stepped back onto the mound. I'd be happy. Talking to Enos Aris of The Athletic. Also, there was this report today that Major League Baseball is going to do these pre-tacked baseballs in select AAA games as they do their final stretch games, or whatever they're calling it, here in September. You've written extensively about how maybe the sticky stuff is creeping back into the game. Would this just be a way of making it uniform? What do you think about this?
Well, they got some pushback from the players about potential injury risk, about holding the ball tighter because you don't have the same grip. Maybe this is an olive branch to the players and be like, you know, here's a better ball. Some of the players said, we went to the pine tar because the balls were so hard to grip, they were like cue balls. And there was a big change in 2015 to the ball. That's why we're in the live ball era again in baseball. That's why 2019 broke all records for home runs. So, you know, there's some truth to that. So maybe they're just trying to do something for the players that the players want. But I also think, you know, they're at a stalemate right now where there are some people still using pine tar, whatever, advanced sort of grip enhancement stuff. There are people still using it. And the only way to take another step forward and be more enforce it even harder is to be more draconian about it, I think, and start busting people based on maybe spin rate changes or start testing balls as they arrive at home plate, you know, start putting balls away and testing them. And I think if they do that without doing something to help them with the ball, they may incur more anger from the players. So I think it's a little bit of both, of trying to do something to help the issue from the player side, and then maybe setting the scene for more enforcement in the future.
Yeah, well, it's a change in the baseball. Again, if they're using in that AAA tournament, you know, that that's, you know, again, I know that's the only minor league ball that's still going right at the moment, correct? But that's, that would be a reasonably easy, you can implement that for opening day next year, and it wouldn't be that tough, right?
It's all been always been about the players and if they're into it. The players have actually seen three or four different prototype balls over the last 5 years. And they've tried it sort of without really announcing it. They've given it to players in spring training to see how they feel. In the past, the players have said they don't like it, but I think put against this new enforcement where players are checked, you know, every game for pine tar and stuff, maybe players will be more likely to say, yeah, that's fine. I'd rather have that than be fiddling around trying to grip the ball and throw it 98.
Talking to Eno Saris. Yeah, Blue Jays in Minnesota right now. They just wrapped up a three-game series in Tampa against the Rays, and they lost 2 out of 3, and they lost the season series to the Rays. But the question we've asked each other on this show a couple of times over this week was, does that really look like a World Series contender? And I know they have the best record in the American League, and they've scored more runs than anybody, I think, in the second half of the season. September has not been spectacular for them. What do you make of the Rays? Record would say they're a juggernaut type, and they were just in the World Series a year ago. Do you see that when you evaluate the Tampa Bay Rays?
No, I mean, they've got basically a 500 record in September. And when I look at them personally, I see a different bullpen than they had last year. It's, you know, last year they had, it seemed like, you know, it was the stable of horses that can throw 98.
Yes. Yeah.
I don't really see that this year. They traded away their hardest thrower in Diego Castillo. Fairbanks and Nick Anderson are not what they were even last year. And so you're basically asking a lot of maybe Fireisen and maybe Kittredge to come back. And those guys don't strike me as sort of lockdown relievers. That not the way that Anderson was, you know, before the injury. So I think, you know, it actually depends on more than they'd want to admit. I think a lot depends on their youngest players. Wander Franco, Shane McClanahan, Luis Patino, you know, even Shane Baz. Like, they're going to go as far as those guys take them, I think. Because those are kind of the young stars that are ready to take over.
Because of course Shane Baz would show up for the Rays in September, and like he's the guy that's going to start the World Series clinching game. Like, that's the most Rays thing ever, that he's the PT the player to be named later in that Pirates deal, and he shows up and looks fully formed, right?
He's also their Francisco Rodriguez, right? Their injury replacement. Their 40-man roster manipulation, you know, that comes in, and nobody's seen him all year. Nobody has scouting reports on him, and he just blows everyone away. So, I mean, that's the danger for anybody who faces them, is that Baz, Patino, and McClanahan are their starters, and all these other guys that you've built up scouting reports on that you think you can hit, you know, Yarbrough, very hittable. Well, what if Yarbrough is actually just kind of a mop-up reliever for them in the postseason? That kind of changes a lot.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. Hey, Eno, we appreciate the time. Thanks for doing this.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on. And this, I think, will be a very exciting week. I'm sorry for all the Tums that will be eaten in Toronto. But I also am kind of rooting for that one possible outcome where the Red Sox, the Yankees, and Blue Jays all have the same record on the last day.
Yeah.
Why not get extra baseball?
Yeah, I haven't totally figured out. We will get to that when we have to. We'll figure out exactly how that's going to work. But yeah, man. But in terms of the Tums, right? This is what you live for, right? Like, I've been
exactly.
Yeah, the suffering. That's why you're a baseball fan, for that week of suffering.
And the Blue Jays are such an excellent team. The nice thing about this is they look like they're built for the long haul, and it's a really exciting time to be a Blue Jays fan.
No question about that. Should be exciting tonight, but yeah, especially exciting Tuesday through Thursday against the Yankees. Eno, talk again soon.
All right, thanks for having me.
Eno Saris of The Athletic. Interesting things out of that.
It's always interesting.
Yes.
Like, there's always stuff there that is fantastic. I love listening to him.
I will say that the most excited I got during that was when he said that the robot umps is like almost, it's like certainty.
Yeah, talk about recency bias, though, right? Like, just having watched that. We should tell Pete Walker. It'd make Pete Walker real happy.
Yeah, but the other thing, too, is like, it's so counterintuitive, right? Strikeouts are way up, and everybody throws 100. Yeah, but not for 100 pitches.
Mm-hmm.
You throw 100 for however many, your 20 pitches a game, and those are effective put-away pitches. And it actually, you know what I was thinking about as he was saying it was a breaking ball league or a people are throwing fastballs fewer than ever before, even though they're harder, was that changeup, the two-strike changeup that Julian Merriweather threw yesterday.
83 miles an hour.
Yeah, and it's like, well, you want to kill him for it because he was knocking the bat out of his hand with 97 and 98, and there's been a couple of times there that I've wondered about pitch selection. There was one, I guess, that was the at-bat to load the bases in that second game of the Rays series. It was the 3-2 breaking ball from Jordan Romano where he was throwing 102, and you scratch your head. But it's kind of, if you think about it, I guess more the norm than I would have realized.
Yes. Yeah, that you show the fastball, you show the 100 to set up the other stuff, really, right? But, boy, there are times when that feels like not the right idea. Yeah. And those two instances you pointed to, it didn't seem like the right idea. I didn't, Merriweather's throwing to 97, 98 to set up the 83 at the belt. That was not the best idea.
Yeah, it's a breaking ball lead, but not a breaking ball in the middle of the zone league. That's never going to work.
Nope.
All right. More of Writer's Block and we continue. Ben Annis, Stephen Brunt, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Sorry, I needed to take a second to verify the stat that I was about to say because it sounded so outlandish when I saw it that I was like, I better double check that. You know who's now tied for first in the NFL in rushing touchdowns?
No, go for it.
Sam Darnold.
There you go.
Sam Darnold has 3 now, which is tied with Derrick Henry and Nick Chubb. And he's escaped the clutches of not only the New York Football Jets, but also Adam Gase, who, boy, man, what a legacy.
Yes.
Kevin Clark of The Ringer with this nugget yesterday. And there's a lot. I think you're so correct in not being on Twitter so many times. But these are the things that you miss
out
on.
This is what I'm missing. Okay, tell me what I'm missing.
Okay, Kevin Clark. You think the Gase thing is a little funny meme because Tannehill and Darnold improved post-Gase. And because the Broncos won the Super Bowl immediately after he left, then you see he left LSU after 2002 and they won the national title in 2003. Then you realize how deep it goes. But subsequent to that, he had not finished digging. There was a follow-up tweet. This also from Kevin Clark, a threaded tweet. I regret to inform you, this is not a joke that Adam Gase's Michigan High School Marshall won the state title in the first season after his 1996 graduation. That is impossible. So I would.
That's so cruel.
But
true.
I guess that would mean, though, the Jets are going to have some level of success post-Gase, which doesn't seem that is necessarily true.
No, that's not in the immediate future. No, that doesn't seem true. I watched a little bit of the football game. Well, between Michael Pineda pitches, right?
Yeah.
Like I got to see a fair bit of football, you know? Just
I had a cable problem, click. So I couldn't really join you in that.
Yeah, Sam Darnold looked really good. He looked really good. Now, you know, the Texans actually tried, though. Like, they were better than – they weren't as hopeless as billed. And the kid from Stanford, the giant, tall guy playing – he looked okay.
Neck.
Yeah, he looked okay. You know, he looked all right. But – and it was – you know, it was close. And then, the Carolina put it away. I don't know if they look like a conference champion or anything like that. Or Chuba Hubbard, Canada's own, got into the game because McCaffrey got hurt. He got stuffed on short yardage a couple times. But other than that, I thought looked – pretty good. He did not catch a pass down at the goal line that Darnold really whistled to. Mm-hmm. So there maybe was a little bit of down there, but you know, he ran hard, had a couple of three or four really good runs, and he's going to get some work now.
Yeah. I mean, the Panthers are off to this spectacular start, and I don't think anybody's putting them in the Super Bowl or anything, right? Just because they're 3-0, they have not knocked down one of the Titans of the NFL, not the actual physical Titans who play in the NFL.
Mm-hmm.
But the Panthers have looked okay. And Sam Darnold, again, not in the MVP conversation, haven't checked his odds, despite the fact that he leads the NFL in rushing touchdowns. I don't think anybody's like, well, Sam Darnold now all of a sudden is a star. But guess what he is? He's an adequate NFL quarterback, good enough that he could be, let's say, an average quarterback, that on a good team, he could not screw it up. The thing that made that team special, though, or could have, and was Christian McCaffrey.
Yeah.
And it's, listen, I don't play fantasy anymore. Fantasy people were losing their minds that he went out yesterday, which he tends to do.
Yes, he does. But he's the ultimate fantasy player, right?
Yes, because he does everything.
He does everything.
And he's an all-purpose yards, like 200 yards a game guy. But it's not dissimilar to Lourdes Gurriel Jr., who's been star-crossed with the injuries, and this is the first time in his career he's played 100 games. This is just, it's been one of those things where it's been difficult to get him through a 16 and, well, now a 17 game season.
You know, whatever they're going to be this year, it would be predicated on him coming back and him. But, you know, if he were healthy at the end of the season, like, they look like a playoff team for sure.
Yeah.
And the thing I like about Darnold, unlike a lot of, you know, like, not every quarterback in that league, you know, gets the ball downfield, right? There's still a lot of dink and dunk in that league, you know, not with Patrick Mahomes and those guys, but there's a lot of dink and dunk in that league. And he was throwing the ball downfield really well. You know, he was well over 300 yards again last night. And I thought he was aggressive. You know, they were giving him really good. He had time to throw too, but he's got a terrific arm.
Yeah.
You know, and you understand why they drafted him there, right?
He went to USC and was regarded as, I mean, at one point was going to be the first overall selection in that draft. And the guy who was supposedly the quarterback whisperer was going to whisper sweet nothings into his ear. What ended up happening is he just saw ghosts under the tutelage of Adam Gase. And, yeah, it's easy to point to that as being the reason things didn't work out there. But I do believe a little bit in the Jets, not the just putting on the uniform and that becoming a thing, but that fan base and the angst that surrounds that fan base when it comes to young quarterbacks. And I'm thinking back to the conversation we had with Alvin Williams about how different it could be for this Raptors team and Scotty Barnes, because there isn't that. Because they were just, you know, hoisting the Larry O'Brien trophy 2 years ago, that maybe around the NBA and certainly in Orlando, they'll be laughing at Scotty Barnes if Jalen Suggs gets off to this great start and Scotty Barnes is looking like he has a broke jump shot. But I think the fans here in Toronto, and maybe I'm being too Pollyannic about it, but I think they will, you know, embrace him to a degree. Now, it's like you got a one-year grace period.
But they believe it, you know, but that goes into the faith in the organization thing, right? Like that if you believe in the organization and if he scuffles off the, you know, out of the gate, the belief in Masai and Masai Ujiri and everybody who works for him is such that people figure it'll work out, right? Because, you know, that he's not going to be Bruno Caboclo.
Yeah, it's weird how that changes, because it used to be that you looked at that uniform and you thought about that franchise. That was not the thing that you thought.
Nope, you thought about, well, let's go through the list, right?
Yeah. It used to be a lot more similar to what it feels like as a Jets fan right now, but couldn't have more divergent franchises at the moment. All right, when we come back, we'll talk to our man on the ground in Minneapolis, Arash Madani, get an update on Lourdes Gurriel Jr., whether he'll be available as early as tonight as the Blue Jays continue their series against the Twins. It is Writer's Block. Ben Ennis, Stephen Brunt, Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
You're listening to Writer's Block with guest host Ben Ennis and Stephen Brunt on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
All right, hard to imagine there's as many horrors in store for the Blue Jays tonight down at Target Field. And I should knock on wood before I say that. But yeah, the Blue Jays lose the game, and they lose a couple of players due to injury. Thomas Hatch and, of course, Lourdes Gurriel Jr., who gets spiked by Randall Grichuk in left field. Had a couple of stitches, but apparently no broken finger. So that's good. Let's talk to our man on the ground in Minnesota, Arash Madani. Joins us now. How's it going, Arash?
I'm doing well, Ben. How you doing, man?
Doing very well. Great reporting throughout this road trip. What is the latest on Gurriel, and what do you expect tonight?
I don't expect him to play. I mean, it's what you just outlined. He had the two stitches in the middle finger. The x-rays were negative, which I guess is a better than the alternative. But, and I think, and understandably so, Gurriel's having a crazy September, like among the best in franchise history September. And I know I don't want to get too into who's the third line, fourth line winger here and into depth stuff, but I actually think the Thomas Hatch thing, the hamstring that now appears like it's going to cost him the rest of the season, I actually think that's as significant a loss. Because the Blue Jays can hit, and presumably stitches means Gurriel can return in a few days. The Blue Jays don't have a lot of length in that bullpen, and Hatch was stretched out to 5 innings. Removing that leaves only Ross Stripling, who can give you, bulk. And I think that's a significant loss to them coming down the stretch.
Yeah, it's definitely a complicated, if in case of emergency, if they have one of those situations, a rash, we were talking about it earlier in the show, there's not a whole lot of alternatives.
But Steve, it's not even emergency. I mean, Mats went 80 pitches in 3 innings yesterday. Who knows what Ryu's status is right now?
No, but what I would say is that, by and large, that rotation, and you're right about both of those things, but the rotation has given them a bit of length this year, pretty consistently in the back half of the year. So they haven't had to go to that kind of a guy that often in the second half. And now you may well have to, the uncertainty around Ryu and his start and what you're going to get. Although in theory, Mats could be your long guy that day because he would be on his normal rest. But there's the other part of that is, Arash, there's not really anybody, if you look at kind of beyond Tom Hatch in Buffalo, you've got Anthony Kay, I guess you've got, there's not a lot of alternatives there, right? There's not another guy who you could drop in there and say, this is our in case of emergency, give us 3 innings guy. Not anybody that you would feel good about.
Right. And I guess Stripling might be the only one, although he got shelled the other day in Tampa. So look, the Gurriel's bat is massive, especially in the six hole, especially with the tear that he's been on. I was actually studying some numbers the other day, guys. Like his walk rate has just skyrocketed and continually gone up over the last 3-4 months. So yeah, you lose some offense, but I saw Thomas Hatch walk off the field yesterday. When they said hamstring, I'm saying to myself,
See in February, right?
Right. Like, it's just very little margin for error now.
Yeah.
And especially a guy that I had high hopes of impacting not just the bullpen, but the rotation this season, to see the way his year has gone is disappointing. And it looked like such a good trade with the Cubs, David Phelps. So Gurriel, back to him for a second, because we've wondered what the correlation could be in regards to George Springer's ability to get back onto the field defensively. Arash, what have you seen as the progression for him before these games, and how close do you think he could be, and would this injury impact the timeline for him?
Okay, so I'll preface this by saying all of this is speculation, but it's speculation based on conversations with people in the know at the Blue Jays, and I spoke with Springer himself yesterday. So this is what I can tell you. What I saw with my eyes was Springer in center field yesterday doing defensive drills, and did it for quite some time. What Springer told me after is that he's feeling better, but he wasn't sure exactly when. And he said, it's one of those deals where tomorrow I will see. Now, somebody told me about 3 weeks ago, it was, a 25% mental thing and 75% physical thing. Somebody in the know says that's probably flipped now. Although when he does his start and stops defensively, he does feel pain in the knee. So that's the kind of bigger 10,000 foot view of the whole thing. Now Gurriel's hurt. Does that mean, George, we know you're hurting, you got to get back in there? Maybe. It's just the last 20 games. When you look at it, Springer's offensive numbers as DH, and it's not the same being a DH as you're an outfielder, his offensive numbers haven't been that strong either. So the one thing he said yesterday is this has been the most difficult season for me. Mentally, I've had to learn so much. It's been a grind. I've had to stay engaged. I've learned that. And, be a good teammate, all those things. At this stage, you would think it's all hands on deck. Except, fellas, that's a $150 million investment. And it's the long haul here, so it's really balancing a lot of things in the equation before just saying Gurriel's out. I guess this means, George, you have to go.
Yeah, no, I don't think there's such a thing as you have to go. because he's going to have to pronounce himself fit. I would say, Arash. I think that's probably
it's his call now, Steve.
Yeah,
that's for sure.
Yeah, and the fact he's not wearing the brace at this stage is obviously a good sign. But I would assume that he wouldn't be running the bases or doing anything if they thought he could aggravate the injury, because for all the reasons you just outlined, you wouldn't take that risk with a knee with a guy that's, you know, is a long term. If you thought he was going to make it worse, he wouldn't be playing. So then it gets down to, and we went through this, or the Jays have gone through this. It happens in sports all the time, but think of, Josh Donaldson's calf, right? Like, that wasn't about, somebody looking at an MRI and saying you're ready or you're not ready. In the end, it was about whether he was willing to play or not, or, whether he deemed himself fit. This is kind of the way it works. It's not like you say, buddy, you got to go out there and play because we've got a hole in the lineup. But the flip side of that is Arash, and you're right, he hasn't hit at all in this stretch, but it's not like this is an area of depth, right? Outfield. They don't have a lot of good alternatives. And, he would be, among other things, even if he's not hitting, he's a defensive upgrade out there, as long as he can run, which it appears he can. He's running the bases. He's a better defensive outfielder than just about anybody else they've got.
Right. And so what do you do? Do you put Teoscar, if Springer goes, you put Teoscar in left? Grichuk in right, is that the play? And then Springer goes in center.
You put Springer wherever he's the most comfortable. I think that's
probably center,
which is probably in center. So that's what I would do, because it's either that or it's Dickerson, right? Like, you're not like, and there's not who's not a center fielder at this stage, and even though he's played there for them, so like there's not a lot of great, the best outcome is you get Gurriel back and he's playing out there, and he's especially taking his turn in the lineup, but. Maybe getting Springer in the outfield helps unlock him at the plate a little bit. I know people have suggested that, but like, no, it's not stuff you, they, it's,
and there are some people in the Blue Jays front office who have suggested that too.
Yeah. So, cause it's not, I'm not sure what I'm seeing at the plate with him right now, but these are not questions you'd like to be having answered in the last 10 days of a season like this, but here you go. Welcome to adversity. It's like, it's not like other teams haven't dealt with it.
You know what I'm curious? Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, when we're talking about Springer here and in the offensive struggles, and they've been pronounced in September, he has an OPS of 507. And and Kevin Barker was talking about this as we ended the show yesterday, about how mentally it can be a relief for you to play the other half of the game and at least make an impact in that way and maybe take a little pressure off yourself at the plate. But I wonder if there's at all a belief, because he's not 100%. Like, we know this. And when he gets out into the field in center field, he won't be at 100%. Is there any belief that what he's going through offensively is related to the knee? That it is, that's a health thing, that if this was a fully healthy George Springer, okay, you go through slumps, but it wouldn't be quite like this, that this is related to the knee thing?
Yeah, I think only George Springer knows the answer to that question, and maybe he doesn't even either. I think that there's a lot of theories out there when somebody who had been hitting so well before the injury in that 20-game span, if you're looking at that as a sample size, has been so poor here. And John Schneider was saying all the right things yesterday. He said, Springer's close, and he's just a barrel or two away from breaking out of it. And, they're saying, thinking, wishing, hoping, all of the right things. And maybe that is all that it takes, but it just hasn't happened in a while. So, look, amidst all this, the Blue Jays have three to go with Minnesota and three to go with Baltimore.
Yeah.
So with, another three with the Yankees. Like, 6-3 should get you in.
Mm-hmm.
So even without Gurriel and even with a struggling Springer, and you have Berríos, Ray, Manoah coming up, I mean, they're in a good position. They just now got to go out there and do it.
Yeah, and their rotation's set up for these three games, obviously, with Minnesota. But we were talking about this early in the show, Russ. Those three games for the Yankees, it's like a de facto playoff series, right? Like, and it's going to feel like that because the dome's going to be as full as it's been in 2 years, and it is the Yankees, and you can kind of control your own destiny coming out of that. So given that, do you have any sense? I know, kind of trying to figure out how Ryu is and kind of where he is a bit of a mystery, I think, for everybody. But, how secure they feel about him taking his turn on Tuesday?
I think he's going to go Tuesday. He threw yesterday in Minnesota. He threw the day before in Tampa. you know, they're saying all the right things. They're happy with, you know, the shape of the ball, how we looked, et cetera. This is really not a neck issue. This is a take a breather, get yourself sorted. You know what it takes to perform in October. You've done it before. Let's just get you out of the pressure cooker, off the hamster wheel for a minute, and take care of you. And so that's kind of been the thought process in all of this. I had actually thought, could it be a forearm thing? Because at Yankee Stadium a couple of weeks ago, he threw more sliders, left the game, and he'd thrown some sliders in that home game. I am told it's not a forearm thing. I'm told it's really not an injury thing. It's a, let's get it together. Just let's pump the brakes a little bit, exhale, figure out what you got to figure out. Maybe we'll make a tweak or two. But as far as everything I've been made to understand, guys, the plan is Ryu Tuesday against New York.
So there are things they can look at in these side sessions. We wondered, because the radar readings weren't going to tell us much, but yeah, they're looking at the shape of his breaking ball. They're looking at the way the ball is coming out of his hand and saying that there's something different there.
I don't know exactly that, Ben, but Ryu's on his own schedule and Ryu knows himself. I mean, that's that much we do know. So, you know, sometimes when you're just going and it's a long season and you're in the thick of it and, you know, the pressure starts to mount, it, even for a vet, sometimes just getting off that for a quick minute can be a benefit. And that's what they're kind of hoping here.
Well, that feels huge, though, that Tuesday start, doesn't it? Really? You know, because, you know, again, if he comes out and does what he's done to the Yankees before, if they get a quality start out of Ryu, it doesn't have to be, you know, it doesn't have to even be an all world start, but if he can keep them in that game with the pitching they have coming behind him, it's going to feel pretty good, right? You're going to feel pretty good
even
about
if he
everything.
Gives them five, Steve. Yeah. Even if he, you know, it's just one of those things where suddenly, not just for that start, but the confidence that's going to give everybody that, okay, we can go to him. You know, we can rely on him for the next one and especially the one after that.
Yeah, and we'll see. Talking to Arash Madani. So it's all, everybody's expecting Ryan Baraki to say, you know what, on second thought, slap that suspension on me today. Do you expect that to be the case, that he's going to drop his appeal of that suspension?
Well, when I saw him come out, I was 100% convinced of it. And then when I saw Thomas Hatch leave the game, I was a little less convinced of it, just because of the lack of bullpen depth. And then Ben Nicholson-Smith slapped me around post-game. He said, no, he's going to drop the suspension. So I don't like to be slapped too much. You sit out the next three. You have a fresh bullpen now, because for the last 2 days, Meza hasn't gone. Romano hasn't gone. Castro didn't go yesterday. On and on it goes. So suddenly you now have some provisions back there. I would suspect that's the case. I'm interested. I mean, the obvious move for the Hatch injury, I guess, is Taylor Salcedo. Just call him back up. Mm. I just think they would love to have somebody other than him. But, Steve, you mentioned it earlier, I don't think anybody exists. Anthony Kaye just got called, you know, just was reactivated off the COVID list. So who knows what kind of physical shape he's in. So I just don't know what other provisions they have back there.
No one on that Buffalo roster really jumps out at you right now saying I'm the guy. But you're right. Like the important half of the bullpen is fresh. You know, they've run out some of those other guys. And that's, you know, I think that's going to be one of the interesting stories over this weekend, Arash, because obviously the starting pitching is set up for these three games. They've got to feel really good about the starting pitching. And they feel really good about four guys in that bullpen. But the question will be, I think, how hard you're willing to ride those guys. You've got an off day coming Monday. We're talking about Romano, Meza, Simber, and Richards, right? Your big four in the bullpen. Are any of those guys going to pitch 3 days in a row? Like, because I think it's that time of year, isn't it?
Yeah, and this is why, we always say it's the biggest series of the year, the biggest games of the year, the biggest starts of the year. I actually really believe this, that these three games are the biggest of the season, even with the Yankees coming in, because these are the most winnable games with your best starting pitching going, with your hottest starting pitching going. And you have, if they can give you six or seven, that's huge. And I know we're getting into real minutia here, talking about Baraki, but as much as the my dad is better than your dad move he made by plunking Kiermaier, that burned Nate Pearson that day, Wednesday.
Mm-hmm.
Nate Pearson could have pitched yesterday, which would have saved you Adam Simber last night. But instead, Simber had to come out in a nothing game. Mm-hmm. So that's why these three starts are so huge. And then, yeah, depending on how deep and far they go, I can very much see this being a huge start for Alek Manoah and a huge start for Robbie Ray. And if they get that, they're in a massive advantage position going into next week. And if they don't, that's when it really gets hairy.
Yeah, because and plus you got the Yankees and Boston playing each other, right? So somebody's going to lose. So you're right. If they look, sources say. So if they could win, if you win these three games, whatever happens, you're kind of in the catbird seat heading into those Yankee games.
Yes, no question. But you need these three.
You do.
Just the math. That's not forget the analytics. It's just the standings. That's why these three are so important.
Yeah, hard to imagine you wouldn't be in a playoff spot if you won all three of these games by the end of it. So tonight, 8:00. Tomorrow, 7:00. Sunday, 2:00. And then at 4:25, just a couple of miles away in Minnesota, the Vikings will host the Seahawks.
Oh my!
Arash Medani will be in Minnesota, and I guess watching it from your hotel room.
No, I'll be watching it from the camera well at Target Field. I mean, first half anyway.
Yeah. Arash, great stuff.
Thankfully,
like I said,
nowhere near the stadium.
I was going to say, you must be just trembling being this close to Kirk Cousins. It must for you must be something, right? Are you okay?
I will not confirm nor deny, Mr. Brent.
All right, see you, Arash.
You like that?
See you, buddy.
Thanks for that, fellas. Always a pleasure coming on with you, huh?
See you, Arash.
See you, man.
Good boys.
Arash Medani. Yeah. Traveling again, which is great. I mean,
isn't that great? Yeah.
There's so much stuff, like this road trip in particular, there's been so much that's happened, but so much color to the stories that we've been talking about all day that Arash can provide, because you know what? He's actually around the team. He's talking to people who are making these decisions. He's talking to the players who are involved in the decision-making. That kind of makes a difference.
May I make a public service announcement here, please? Because I know as an old reporter, reporting matters.
Yeah.
You know, actual reporting, like there's a difference. Like Zoom calls are not reporting.
Yeah.
And that's all we had, obviously, but it matters. It matters to have a guy on the ground. It matters to have those conversations that are not formal and scripted. It matters to be able to walk up to a guy in batting practice and say, hey, what's going on with so-and-so?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it matters to have somebody with the team who knows the sport and knows the guys and, you know, and actually can do their work. It's been, because I don't know what it's going to be like once this is over, whether everybody's going to send their reporters back on the road to cover teams because it's cheaper if you don't.
Yeah.
But there's enormous value. If you're a fan, you know, you should be rooting for that because there's enormous value. And as you say, this week, with all of the weird twists and turns of this week, to have people there who could actually talk to folks has been invaluable. And that's, you know, we're lucky to have them.
I don't know if we get the hour, 2 hours of radio around Kevin Kiermaier's stealing of that sheet without Arash Medani's reporting.
No, we do. We definitely don't.
Yeah.
We definitely don't. So, yes, here's to the reporters and let's keep them on the road and let's keep them close to the teams because we need them.
Amen to that. When we come back, let's talk to the Toronto Maple Leafs captain. John Tavares joins us next as Writer's Block continues. Ben Ennis, Stephen Brunt, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Writer's Block, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, Ben Ennis and Stephen Brunt. Time for some Oakville talk between two Oakvillians, myself and our next guest.
Oakvillians, right? No, is it Oakvillians or Oakvillians?
Did I say Oakvillians?
Villians, yeah, I think you did.
I think you made a Freudian slip calling me an Oakvillian.
Well, but so when Hamilton, that's how we always thought of you guys.
All right, it is John Tavares, a Toronto Maple Leafs captain who joins us on the line. How's it going, John? Thanks for doing this.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
So obviously a very abrupt end to your season last year in a shocking turn of events that happened in game one against the Montreal Canadiens. How did that impact your offseason, John, and maybe just even mentally, psychologically, not being there with your teammates on the ice for the final six games of that series?
Yeah, I'll answer the first part of your question. Honestly, the offseason couldn't have gone better in terms of being fairly normal just because of the amount of time. And, you know, traditionally when your season ends, just taking a few steps back, getting some time to recover, you know, mentally disconnect and kind of reassess where you're at. And in general, you know, you just kind of want to build yourself back up again. So it was kind of a good scenario that way. And I was able to just kind of continue to progress, you know, check each box and you know, got back on the ice really quickly as I thought it was going to be really important in my recovery, but also in my preparation for this season and got cleared for all on-ice activities very early on in July as things were going really well and just continued to progress from there with a pretty normal off season in terms of the way I approach my program and the way I try to prepare and whatnot. So that was great. Obviously it was extremely difficult not to be out there to help my teammates and be a part of the best time of year playing in playoff hockey. And obviously with the expectations and the type of year we were having, not to be out there to help. And obviously in those critical games, never easy for any hockey player and athlete will tell you. It's always harder to watch, and there's nothing better playing and getting to play in those games and in those moments. So it is what it is. It's something that happened. I'm just very fortunate that there was nothing more significant than the incident. You know, I responded extremely well. I've gone back to great health and feeling really good, and have a good time to prepare for a new journey and new opportunity this year. Excited about what's in store for us and what's ahead, and the players that we've added and the group that we got. So all has gone really well.
John, I heard you at the opening press conference. I heard you talking about the collision against Montreal and about how you immediately afterwards you didn't have any memory of it actually happening, although you did bounce back pretty quickly. And you know, if you guys had got to the next round, it sounds like you would have been playing. But I was wondering, did you go back? Did you go back and ever, have you gone back and looked at that on film?
Yeah, I haven't. As I thought about it and as kind of part of my recovery, I worked on the mental side of it a little bit and going through something like that. And I think for me that my approach is I've acknowledged that it's happened. It was significant. And I'm not naive to that, but to me, I'm just moving forward. And, you know, I don't really see any need to kind of rehash the past or see what happened. I think there'll be, I'm assuming there's going to be a time that I'm going to see it just because in the era we live with technology and stuff that gets put out onto TV or the internet, and it'll probably pop up one day. And if I see it, I see it. I know that something significant I went through. I've seen the reactions from my family, my friends, my teammates, you know, the amount of support and, the outpouring support, like I said, from the hockey community in many different areas. Obviously, being on a stretcher, going to the hospital, being in the ambulance, you acknowledge that something obviously happened, and when you don't remember, it couldn't have been easy to watch or easy for people to see. So for me, it's just just continue to move forward. I've been really fortunate. It couldn't have gone better in terms of being discharged from the hospital, all my imaging and all my scans that I had, to all of the specialists that I was seeing, the people that were helping me out, things went phenomenally well. So to me, it's about just continuing to move forward. Obviously mentally address it like I've had, and I've had good discussions with people over the off season and get prepared physically and mentally for this year.
Talking to John Tavares, Toronto Maple Leafs captain, we will move on, but yeah, I think a lot of people still have some unanswered questions about that time for yourself and this team. And I think most Leaf fans just thought, yeah, well, obviously immediately about whether you'd be okay just from a human being standpoint. And then the idea that you were skating at some point while that series was continuing, the idea that you might possibly even return to that series, was that ever a realistic chance, John? Because I think people were shocked when they saw you on the ice.
Yeah, there was no chance of the series. I think there was no doubt about that. I think it was just continuing the progression of the rehab, and honestly, every day was just kind of reassessing where I was at. I obviously made tremendous strides right away. I had a great team of people, you know, obviously within the organization and the care that I was under our medical and performance staff, and then with some of the people that I work outside of the organization, kind of collaborating, working with, and on top of things, obviously right away, and just getting me tremendous care and great guidance and how to continue to progress from obviously getting really positive news that at the, you know, structurally and all my imaging, everything was clean as a whistle and extremely sound, to, you know, basically having no symptoms coming out of the hospital other than just being really tired from the shock of the incident and really not getting a whole lot of sleep that night, trying to catch up with people and let everyone know that I was okay. So after those first couple of days, again, some good nights of rest and just kind of getting back into a normal routine, things progressed really well. But I think, no question, there were still some significant hurdles and steps that I've had to get through to get back to being cleared to play. But anytime you're able to kind of make that type of progression, it gets you obviously excited and feeling good that you're headed in the right way. When I would have been able to return, we'll never know. Hopefully it would have been sooner rather than later if things continued on. But, you know, once the year ended, I put the gear away for about a month and, you know, didn't completely get away from it, but definitely scaled things back in terms of the recovery and then just wanted to build myself back up, getting ready to go for my off-season program as I normally would. So that was kind of where things were at then.
In terms of kind of looking ahead to this season and, you know, maybe taking something from the disappointment of that series, you know, what happened against Montreal and the possibilities of that season kind of going up in smoke in the first round. When you talk to your teammates, you know, what, you know, how did losing that series, you know, impact these guys? And in terms of, you know, getting over that hurdle and taking a step with a team that, you know, had an incredibly good regular season, you know, in the weirdest circumstances imaginable last year, but a great season. You know, how did you sense kind of the growth potential of this team coming out of that?
Well, yeah, I mean, we've obviously had some disappointments. Last year was a significant one. You know, I think since I've been here, they've all been hard. We've had very high expectations with our group and what our potential is. And, you know, it's not something, you know, we take lightly. I think everything that we've, we invest mentally, physically, emotionally, every year, every day is very high. Guys care, so much. I think it's just continuing, to figure out, the avenues, the ways that we need to get better at and unlock to help us break through. I think no question we have to just kind of go right at this challenge and this hurdle that's been facing us. And it is what it is. It's something that people are talking about, something that obviously we're aware of. The disappointments that we've had, and that's what we're up against, but we have another great opportunity to go out there and earn that chance again and get another opportunity in the playoffs to overcome that, as I kind of said in the off season, just kind of keep beating on that door until we knock it down. I think there's a tremendous amount of belief in this group amongst ourselves within the organization. So just continue to stick together, learn from these challenges and these disappointments, and continue to build on the tremendous areas of growth. As you said, there was a lot of real positives out of last year, and we obviously earned those expectations because of the way we played and the type of regular season we had. So we know we need another good one to get that opportunity again. So we're going to start there and continue to build from there. And you know, that we got to go right at this challenge and this hurdle that we've been facing here for a few years.
Talking to John Tavares, Wayne Simmons today was talking about the meetup that happened amongst Leaf players at your cottage in the off season and the conversations that you had. Like, it was, did you find it important to address this like in a direct way, conversationally? Can you give us some insight into what those conversations were like over the time that I guess everybody was at your cottage?
Yeah. Yeah, I guess Simmer
spilled the beans. Sorry,
some insight today. No, it's all good. I'm just laughing amongst myself, just because it was a phenomenal few days of having a bunch of bunch of other guys that were kind of in town, and we've also obviously got quite a few local guys. And I just thought it was a good time to kind of reconnect with a bunch of us. Some of the new guys, get them kind of acquainted away from the team facilities, and kind of just getting to know each other a little bit more personally on a personal level, and still put some good work in, some good training, some good good time on the ice together, and just a different environment, and just kind of us together and enjoying one another, and just kind of if things were going to happen and discussions were going to happen naturally, organically, just kind of let it kind of go that way. And I think as a group, we recognize the disappointments we had and you know, the challenges that we've been facing and how we want to overcome them. And we're just continuing, like I think we've always had to, you know, find our way to get there and learn from it and push each other and learn from one another and understand how we can grow and be better. And like I said, just continuing to go right at this difficulty of getting to where we want to get to you know, working together on that. So it was a great time, just enjoying one another, putting in some good work, preparing for the season, and a little change of scenery from a lot of guys that have been in the city for a long periods of time, you know, training here, being at the team facility, and just a good way to kind of catch up and get ready for the season.
It looks like by the time you guys open the season, it looks like you might be able to have, you know, close to a full house at the Scotiabank Arena. This talk, the capacity limits have obviously been increased, but more than zero. Let's put it that way, John. Like, what do you think it's going to feel like? You know, like, I can't imagine how weird it was for you guys skating out on the ice in those empty buildings. And I know there was noise and music and the announcers and all of that stuff, but, you know, empty seats. What do you think it's going to be like skating back out on a home ice with actual people in the stands?
I think it's going to be really special. It's obviously been a very difficult time around the world, but certainly for our community, our city here, in many ways, in our own ways, and not to have them be a part of last season, you know, and we obviously had the bubble experience as well. It's been a long time, and we miss them greatly. You know, they're and tremendous inspiration and to the foundation of this organization and this team and the history and tradition of the Toronto Maple Leafs, and such a fabric of the community. Already getting ready for training camp, and you know, when the calendar turned in September, seeing all the amount of people around town wearing Leafs gear and getting ready for the hockey season, and just knowing what that buzz is like and that feeling's like coming in Scotiabank and playing in front of our fan base and seeing all the blue and white, it's pretty remarkable, and we really missed it last year. We know what a boost that can be for us, so we're really looking forward to tomorrow night and what's ahead. And like you said, hopefully things will only continue to get better, increase, and we see the full building here soon.
Yeah, you said it. A taste of it tomorrow night against the Montreal Canadiens at Scotiabank Arena in a game you can watch on Sportsnet. John, thanks for doing this. Best of luck.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
There's John Tavares, Toronto Maple Leafs captain, Oakvillian. Well, I may be the Oakvillian. I don't think I've ever made the noise that I made when I saw John Tavares take that Corey Perry knee to the face.
Yeah.
I was watching with my kids, and I didn't know what happened. Like, and then you see the first replay, and I thought, hand up, I thought his eyes were bleeding. I thought there was blood coming out of his eyes, but what it was his visor got knocked into his face, and it was like a cut around his eyes. But I didn't know if I saw somebody lose their life on the ice. Like, that was a possibility that I was accepting as a reality.
It was terrifying. Yeah, it was. Like, I understand. I don't blame him for not going back to watch it. And he's right. He probably will end up, it'll somehow get into his sight line at some point, whether he likes it or not. But not remembering that might be a bit of a blessing.
Yeah, no question about it. Maple Leafs and Montreal Canadiens, the first time since Game 7, a game that means slightly less, but still something. Dag nabbit, tomorrow night.
Dag nabbit.
Let's watch it after the Blue Jays game on Sportsnet. All right, more Writer's Block, and we continue. Ben Ennis, Stephen Brunt, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. What a treat for you, listener of Toronto Sports Radio.
Yes, indeed.
Not that you listen to us, but I mean, we're okay. But you just heard from the captain of the Toronto Maple Leafs, and in a mere 20 minutes time, you will listen to Minnesota Twins third baseman, former Toronto Blue Jays 2015 American League MVP, Josh Donaldson, joining Kevin Barker and Jeff Blair.
Yes. Yes.
That's going to be very interesting.
I've heard the Barker-Donaldson conversation before around a batting cage. It is a fascinating conversation.
I'm expecting a few fewer expletives.
Yes, perhaps. you wouldn't get those from Bark anyway. But yes, from Donaldson, potentially, yes. He'll know he's on it. But they talk hitting. I've heard those two guys talk hitting, and it's like it's a continuous conversation that occasionally is interrupted by, you know, the world, but they just go right into it, and it's fascinating. Like, I have no idea. Like, I honestly don't understand it, because I don't know anything about hitting a baseball except watching guys do it. But yeah, it's they're two guys who talk about it like it's like science.
Well, nothing me.
There he is.
Donaldson is a really interesting guy when it comes, well, one with new media. He has kind of reemerged on Twitter. Again, you wouldn't know, but he has reemerged on Twitter to discuss hitting, though, right? Mm-hmm. Like, he does, like, little Q&As. People can ask him about hitting. He's done things on, I think, Fangraphs. He did a Q&A as well. But he likes to get into the weeds of hitting. And, yeah, like you, I know nothing about the mechanics of it, despite the fact that I've watched baseball my entire adult life. I've watched thousands of baseball games, thousands of at-bats, and I can make assessments on pitch selection, and I can talk about, hey, Julian Merriweather, you were throwing 97. That looked good. Why'd you go away from it? But I can't tell you why George Springer is having this just awful, awful month, or what makes Josh Donaldson go. That is interesting, though, and I will definitely be listening to those two converse about
that. Well, that's it. We had Bark in here. He visited us. I can reveal that right during the break.
Yeah.
And I said, what are you seeing with George Springer? And I'm sure he'll talk about it, or he has talked. I know he's talked about it. But, I have people who've actually done it, explain it, and talk about what they're seeing and what they're not seeing. I'm forever fascinated. I like to just sit back quietly like a little mouse in the corner and listen to the jocks.
Yeah, from my uneducated vantage point, I would say that what is happening here is not related to the injury, especially if we've got a guy who's getting healthier by the moment. And he's hit the ball hard a couple of times. But I will say, when I saw the Blue Jays sign George Springer, I thought about those epic plate appearances he had in postseason series, mm-hmm. where he would work pitcher into hitter's counts and then come through, you know, numerous times, enough to win a World Series MVP award. And I will say that, and I know this team is so good at hitting first pitches, it's the best hitting first pitch team in all of baseball, but I didn't expect to see as much of it, as much as I've seen out of George Springer, especially this month. And if I was going to put my, hey, why is that happening hat on, I would say that it's because this is a guy who is maybe just wants this thing over and done with. But it's remarkable how often I've seen George Springer in particular swing at the first pitch. And it happened yesterday in a big moment, and it was breaking ball, and it was a soft lineup. But I've seen him swing a lot at first pitches where I didn't necessarily think we would see that.
Well, looking for answers, right? And I think what's understandable, even from the layman's point of view, you know, which is that if part of you is kind of broken down, even as it gets better, it is the complexity of swinging and, you know, trying to hit a baseball, as Bark would say, it's hard, right? And number one, and there's a lot in that motion, right? There are a lot of things going on. And if you mess that up, if you mess one element of that up, or if you're favoring one part of your body, I think the whole thing can get out of whack. You know, I'm not a golfer, but, you know, a golf swing is a complex motion, right? If one thing's wrong, I would think a lot of things, and getting it back, getting back in that, even after you heal, has got to be a bit of a challenge. And you know what, you know, we know what a hitter looks like when they're comfortable, right? Like Lourdes Gurriel.
Yeah.
Right. You know, again, you've seen him look completely lost at other times in his career, but this, you know, locked in Lourdes Gurriel looks like everything. He sees it and he knows it and he processes it before it gets to the plate, and he's ready for it. You know, Springer looks the opposite right now, which is that he's kind of flailing.
Yeah.
And maybe he's going to run into something, but there's just, you know, you don't get that sense that he's seeing the baseball, but confident in his ability. you know, to do what he has to do in this moment.
Well, I'm just trying to transpose what I'm watching right now and how it looks in October and the October baseball that I've seen and the teams that I've seen be successful in October. And Blue Jays are, like I said, they love to swing at the first pitch. Not a lot of guys that'll work a count. And even Vladdy, who has an incredible walk percentage and on-base percentage, likes to swing the first pitch as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I think of the most successful teams in recent memory in the postseason offensively are teams like the Yankees and the Red Sox of their championship vintage, where it was David Ortiz and Manny Ramirez, and you had to put it somewhere they could hit it because they worked you into a count that could get to give them the advantage. And I
don't think this year's Yankees are that.
No, not this year.
This year's Red Sox are a little closer to that. But yeah, I know what you're talking about. That's yes. Deep counts, not being afraid to work two strikes.
Yeah.
And the kind of war of attrition stuff, right?
Yeah. And Vladdy, you can see that stuff happening during the regular season. And you know what? To an extent, Bo Bichette. Now, the problem with him is that he quite often gets into those two strike counts by swinging early in the count. But when he gets to two strikes, he can battle back a little bit. But yeah, I would love to see those two guys and what they could accomplish in a postseason series. You got to get it done, though, in these final nine games of the regular season. Starts tonight in Minnesota as Jose Berríos makes a start against his old team.
You have to feel good about that.
In his old ballpark.
And just feel good about him in general. Like, he's been as advertised, pretty much.
Yeah, save for like a three-start blip. But yeah, something mechanical was apparently off. He's fixed that. He's looked absolutely the part as of recently. And then Robbie Ray hasn't been his Robbie Ray-ish. But he starts tomorrow and then wrap it up with Alek Manoah. And then that off day Monday. And then the series of the season, maybe the series of the decade, depending on what happens, in front of 30,000 fans, the Blue Jays and New York Yankees at Rogers Center starting on Tuesday in what is pretty clearly now going to be Hyunjin Ryu's start. Enough people have told me that it's going to be Hyunjin Ryu that I'm going to defer to those people.
I'm thinking he's going to start. We'll see how long it goes.
Absolutely. Have a great weekend,
Steven. You too, sir.
All right. I'll be back on Monday. Have a great weekend, everybody. Josh Donaldson coming up next as Baseball Central is next with Blair and Barker. It is Writer's Block, Sportsnet 590 The Fan.